Good morning. We'd like to welcome everyone this morning to the meeting of the Mesa Housing Authority Governing Board. Call that to order. I'd like to welcome Mr. Egan, who informed me this is your 10th year. Thank you very much. The first item on the agenda of this of the Governing Board is to conduct a public hearing regarding City Mesa Housing Authority's fiscal year 2013-14 Public Housing Agency Annual Plan. Mary?
Yes. We had our annual plan that commenced 45 days ago, and we're having this meeting just to complete it. We did not receive comments from the public, but we did have some comments from our resident advisory board. Many of the changes that we're proposing from the administrative plan were done in December, and we propose them, and you've already voted on it. So essentially is to provide your direction that and of support for our how we're going to be spending our money, but there's been no major changes since last year.
Okay. Are there any questions regarding this? Any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. There being none, declare the public hearing closed. Next item is to adopt a resolution approving City of Mesa Public Housing Authority annual plan for fiscal year 13-14, authorizing the chairman of the board or as a designated representative to sign and submit the City of Mesa Public Housing Agency annual plan for the same fiscal year to U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Do we have a motion? I have a motion from Mr. Egan. Second from Councilmember Summers. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next is to hear a presentation, provide direction on a support letter for 15 project-based vouchers for the La Mesita Phase 3, provided they are successful in obtaining the 2013-14 Arizona low-income tax credits and if funding permits.
As you know, that we've come before you, and they've also come before you, a new lead for the La Mesita project. Phase one included 30 project-based vouchers, and this is for phase three for 15 project-based vouchers. This is a 20-year commitment from the city. The resident advisory board were in support of this, and they are also present here if you have any questions on the project.
Okay, are there any questions? Councilman Richens.
Can we get a status update on their current project that's under construction?
Sure.
Tori?
Good morning, Council. Status update, La Mesita is well under construction.
Why don't you introduce yourself so everyone, we all know you, but other people may not.
Good morning, I'm Tori Taj from A New Leaf, the Chief Operating Officer. Phase one of the La Mesita apartments are under construction, and the fourth floor is being built at the moment. We are very excited. We are on schedule, anticipate to be completed with the project, and have residents in December.
Okay.
So it's all going very well.
Good. Any other questions for Tori? Thank you.
So I'm requesting direction on a support letter for this.
Okay. We have a motion from Councilmember Richens, second from Councilman Kavanaugh. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Move ahead with the letter.
Thank you.
Hear a presentation, hear a presentation, discuss an update on federal funding reduction related to the sequestration.
Well, we thought we would take a few minutes and just update you on what we know so far. We have been told by HUD and Washington to expect at least a 5% cut. We've been told by our local HUD office to look at a 10% cut. As you recall,
are they keeping the extra 5%? I mean, gee.
I don't know what they're doing.
Now, when you say a 5% cut, effective when?
That would be with this coming year's funding ratio, the 13-14.
13-14.
Yes.
Not current years, but
not current year. We've already received our funding for the current year, and which will take us through the end of June. But as part of council's approval, I believe it was in February, and we will be back for you in front of you for a final approval on May 6th. My dates are all messed up. Where you already approved a methodology for dealing with that. So what you have in front of you is a couple of handouts where we did some scenarios of both a 5% cut and a 10% cut, and what that means to both our organization and our agencies. Here's just an overview of what a 5% cut is to all of those grants. It's a pretty substantial cut. The 5% cut would be around $160,000. If you recall, in February when we were in front of you, we had retained some prior year funds that we did not allocate just for, you know, just something came up, an emergency pot. With the 5% cut, we would be able to cover everything except for almost $5,000 from La Mesita's Desert Leaf Supportive Services Project. The only reason that would have to go down is because it's in a category that has a cap of 15%, and we had maximized that in our allocations. So if our award goes down, our cap goes down. So we would have to take a little bit off of that one. That was the low score. And we'd still have $56,000 in reserve for anything else that may come up. If a 10% cut happens, we would have to use all of those reserves, and we would still have a shortfall of about $77,000. Using the methodology you've outlined, $5,000 to aid to adopt special kids and all $25,000 for Desert Leaf Supportive Services would be eliminated. About $4,000 from West Mesa CDC code compliance would have to be reduced, and about $47,000 from Los Niños Hospital would have to be eliminated. Under ESG, Save the Family Rapid Rehousing, if 5% reduction would lose about $13,000, 10% would be about almost $27,000. However, if you recall, we did give them an additional $81,000 from last year's mid-year allocation that we got, so they're still above what they were anticipating or applied for. And home, because of how we're doing home now, we just have less money to award. There was no award. So on the 24th of this month, the Housing and Community Development Board will be hearing four cases that are requesting home money for their tax credit applications. So we will be analyzing those. We just will have less money. If we don't know by then, we will anticipate some type of cut and hold back a reserve. What this means from an administrative standpoint does affect our funding in our department as well. As you know, most of our department is funded, our staffs are funded with CDBG and grant funds. 5%, we would have to eliminate an office level admin type of position, and 10%, we will have to eliminate a professional level position. Now, I have held some positions vacant in anticipation of this, but we're running pretty lean, which means we have to start can't do business the way we have in the past. We really need to start looking at ways to streamline our processes, look at tasks that take the least amount of admin time but produce the most for us. So we'll probably come back to you this summer with lots of different ideas of how we might change or streamline some processes.
And I'm assuming that since the federal government has reduced the funding, that they also have streamlined their requirements for us. Would I be incorrect in thinking that?
Yes, Mayor, you would be incorrect in thinking that.
Darn.
Some of the things that we have done over this last year, knowing that our funding keeps reducing, is we have developed a monitoring tool. I know I've talked to you over the last couple of years that when we award this money, sometimes we have an obligation to monitor this for the next 20 years. So we've developed a tool to determine the risk of the agencies or the projects so that we can not monitor them every year, maybe every couple of years, depending on the risk level, so that can help streamline. Here's just a list of some of the things we've done to try to streamline our processes, and we continue to always look at other things that we might be able to do to maximize our admin staff. Another issue we have coming up is on May 1st, HUD will look at our account, and we are not allowed to have more than 1.5 ratio of our current year grant in there. The rest should be expended. We're hoping to get close to that, but at this point, it doesn't look like we are going to make that for two reasons. One is La Mesita's homeless shelter. We expected to expend some of those funds. We have awarded them $1.5 million for that shelter. They have ran into issues with their environmental with SHPO. They are at a standstill working through all of that. We cannot do a contract till their environmental has been approved, and we cannot spend money until the contract has been approved. So that 1.5 sitting in the count in HUD's eyes being unallocated really is affecting that ratio. The other part that's affecting that ratio is, as you know, last year we did some major cleanup. We came up with $1.2 million in prior year funds that have been sitting in that count that we did allocate this year. But in HUD's eyes, that is sitting in the count unallocated because it's not allocated until 13-14. So those two major dollars will affect that ratio. We have been talking with HUD, where at this point we don't know what will happen, but we believe we can get close, and we're processing everything we can to try to get as close as possible.
What's the time frame on this?
They will check it on May 1st.
Okay.
On the housing side, we're anticipating about a $500,000 reduction in the money that we use to assist tenants with rent, about $125,000 in admin fees. We did receive some additional VASH vouchers. Our VASH program is being ran so well that HUD offered us, I believe it was 25? They recommended 50, and we received 25, and we're being recommended for more HUD or VASH vouchers this year. Those are the vouchers that serve our veterans. We do have a vacancy in that department or in that area, and we are holding it because currently we are dipping into our reserves every month just paying for staff that we have. So it's not the best place to be. Some of the things that we are looking at to try to streamline those areas is HUD did do a complete seminar of different things we can do in our housing, in our housing program to streamline, most of which we have already incorporated into our practices. But there are a few things we're still exploring, one of which is our payment standard. HUD releases a fair market rents every year for our area. Basically, we can pay for anywhere from 90 to 110% of that, depending on what our admin says. Our admin plan currently says 96%. We pay 96% of that. And that says if there's a one bedroom, you pay this much money. We pay 96% of that. We could reduce that, but that's we have to analyze that because it's a balancing act. If you reduce it, have you made it to the point that it doesn't do them any good? I mean, we still need to help them with their rents. And so it's an analysis that we have to perform and are looking at that. And that would have to come back to you all for approval. We're also benchmarking other authorities, and HUD released a two-year forecasting tool, which we have started to use as well, so that you can start to determine your utilization versus your assistance money, and the calculations for determining these are so complicated. So it creates a yo-yo effect in the funds, but we're looking at trying to stabilize that as best we can using this forecasting tool. Some of the things that we're looking at or have completed already in this area to try to streamline is we've gone to an online waiting application, which should open up soon. What that will mean is the applicant will input all of their data as opposed to our staff. Obviously, that will save us a lot of time. Some of the other things, instead of doing one-on-one training for our annuals or with our landlords, we do group session training now. So we continue to explore new technology with our system so that we can try to make this make it as efficient as it can be. So those are kind of where we are. Again, we don't have an answer at this point. If we have an answer before May 6th, when the annual plan comes before you for approval, we will try to outline what those changes will be and what that submittal will look like to HUD. Otherwise, we will go forward with as it was approved, clear back in February, and then with the methodology approved, and then we will just replace it later on once we finally get a final number.
Okay. Any questions for Tammy? Great. Yeah, Councilman Richens.
Just want to comment how much
work they've done in that department to get it to this point. A lot of training, a lot of patience, a lot of forensic accounting going through, trying to figure stuff out. I just want to commend your department for the hard work that you guys done. And you and the whole staff down there has really done a lot of great work. I just wanted to express my appreciation for what you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Egan.
I can't leave without saying something. This is my 10th year with this distinguished group, and I appreciate your courtesies and everything during the time. I hope I can continue for a while. I noticed I got your usual letter saying unanimously you appointed me. I don't know if that's because of my talent or because there was no opposition. And I'm sure that some of you after the last election felt the same way I did. But seriously,
I was glad to have you. When you call us a distinguished group, I have to question your judgment of character. But you're already in, so I guess we're stuck with you. And glad to be so.
I've been on the advisory board the same amount of time, and one time or 2 years I spent on the another committee of the city, and I learned one thing, that in my 60-plus years in Arizona, I've never heard anything good about Mesa. All the years I lived in Tempe, Phoenix, Tucson, and Flagstaff. And in Flagstaff, I did serve on the city council, and I served on a number of commissions and committees up there. And I was pleasantly surprised in my 17 years living here what has happened to Mesa. It's a great place to live, and I think this council has been super. You've done an excellent job, and I appreciate that very much. I really do. And I just hope that we continue the same good relationship in the future. And the HUD program is excellent. Mary and her crew are doing a great job, and they take very good care of me, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, and thank you for the very kind words. But I have to remind you, we've already elected you, so you know. So you can stop the campaign. No, thank you. We appreciate you because you do give the insight, and you actually bring a little class to this group. So thank you. We do appreciate that. Okay, with that, I have a motion to adjourn from Mr. Egan, a second from Councilmember Kavanaugh. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Egan. We'll now call to order the study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 11, 2013. First item on the agenda is to review the agenda for next Monday evening's regular council meeting. Page 2, items 3A, 2 through 3D. Items 4A through 4C. Items 4D through 4F. Items 4G and 4H. Councilman Richens.
I'd ask some questions about 4H, if we could. You know, the next item is 4I that talks about a hosted online registration system for the parks, and I'm wondering the process that was gone through to decide to do a redundant system in-house, and why what the considerations were about taking that out to a vendor and hosting, because it would seem to me that there might be some wisdom, and there's a lot of companies that store data and can do file sharing and all that stuff, and to build our own system that we're going to have to maintain with hardware upgrades, continual purchases over the years, to spend $800,000 to do this, it seems like we could get a lot of off-site hosting with these companies who professionally manage this kind of thing. And there may be something that I'm missing in that conversation, but it just seems to me like from a cash flow standpoint, it would be cheaper to do it that way. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe not. But you know, this kind of thing would take a lot of manpower and a lot of continual purchase in upgrading this hardware pretty often. You know, it seems like we're always buying computers, and we should be, you know, to make sure that we're on the cutting edge of technology. But what was the process there in deciding to build our own data center instead of going out to lots of vendors who do this kind of thing?
Good morning, Council. Member Richardson and Council. It's actually it's a multi-part strategy. Absolutely, we are looking at what kind of third-party sites and cloud storage for some types of certain kinds of redundant storage. What this particular thing is doing is not necessarily like a disaster recovery or a second site that you would use a third party who are in the business, absolutely, of setting up those types of things. This is to keep a type of high availability going for some of our critical systems. We're not intending to build our entire disaster recovery platform or to duplicate our entire environment like a second data center by any means. There are areas such as some of our software applications that we will move totally to the cloud. There are areas that we will, because of the nature of this document management and our financial systems, that we have to have a ability to process in real time duplicate data and duplicate that today isn't available. We've done some cost comparisons. And as an example, we did a cost comparison of an easy one to put backup in the cloud. And the dollar value wasn't there yet. We're looking to see how we can make it there, but it was actually more costly to move that particular function to the cloud. So, you know, I absolutely were on board with all the different things, but it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all, and we're definitely not building a second data center. What we're setting up here is a base that when we do choose a third-party location, we can lift that equipment and move it over. But it's more than just storage. It's the authentication of how you log into the systems and quite a lot of things that, yes, we could put to a third-party vendor, but not at this stage. Some of that equipment would still need to be bought even if we went to another a different location, a different storage space, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So we're positioning ourselves to move to
that. Is that because function. Of the creating the portal or an interface? Or I throw out all these words. I have no idea what I'm talking about, but it makes me sound halfway intelligent. Is that why? Because it's
heavy.
It's not just like dialing up. We're beyond dial-up, I know. But
for example, what this is really for is for our document management system and to have real-time, you know, within seconds of a duplicate data. There are connectivity issues that we have in terms of services that will be able to provide us that performance, all of that type of thing. The cloud hype is very strong, but we're not there
yet. Give
us
a specific example. In our agenda review, you gave us some specific examples.
So, for example, in our document management system today, when we had an outage, it was 24 hours of data loss that we could occur. What this is going to do is take it down to 15 minutes. That's the kind of business transaction that we need at this stage of the game. When we move to...
Okay, but now take that one right there. 24 okay. hours versus 15 minutes.
Correct.
Now, then, what would that be any different if you were off-site with a third-party vendor?
It could definitely be. Depending on,
but it might. What I'm hearing you say though is that it could be the same. It could be more because you're going out of our system to some duplicative system.
Correct.
Whether it be run by us or partially run by us or correct. All the way in with a third party. I think what I heard you say is that you analyzed that, and the money just wasn't there to create the same capabilities. Was actually more expensive going to a third party.
Correct.
Is that what I heard you say?
In this situation, in that time.
So
at least on
you're saying we're not there yet as far as being able to flip a switch and go to a third party and have the same capabilities for the same or less money.
Correct. They actually call it a hybrid model. It isn't going to be an easy switch. There are going to be different things we're going to do and have to coordinate that. And a lot of it is how big these enterprise systems are and how many systems they're integrated to. If it was simply just take a server and move it to a new location, we'd be doing that. There's so many different factors and different systems that have to integrate. It's like an uplift of the data center. So that's why we're trying to do it in very concentrated, planned moves.
Yeah, I mean,
and looking at the costs as we go along.
Yeah,
the way.
IT is like police radios. We're always buying something. It like never ends. And so I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, do you anticipate this kind of ongoing expense, or do you think technology is going to catch up and the price point is going to catch up that maybe the next time around we don't have necessarily a lot of this stuff we have to do in house, but
I think the price point's absolutely going to catch up. I mean, we're watching and following other cities, and I've got statistics that show that adoption of the cloud is like a 2% spend. The hype makes it sound like it's a 50%. We've all moved our stuff to the cloud. But it's very slow and steady, and a lot of it is the cost. A lot of it is the integration factors. And so I do, am I going to be in front of you every year for a million more to create duplicate sites? No. But we have to do about the big stuff, has to get taken care of now. And we'll do things like the parks registration, all the others, and move those to the cloud, which is a much simpler and less costly proposition.
It does seem like corporate America is really migrating that way, and they've figured out how to successfully and cost-effectively do it. And I'm just really reluctant on this item. I don't know. I don't know enough, but to be able to question. I'm not an IT guru, but it just seemed like, wow, you know, there's
Says the man who has an iPad and an iPhone sitting on the desk in front of him.
It is a version one.
Okay. I'm slow on the uptake, just like we are. So,
Vice Mayor.
Well, we on Audit and Finance have had the same concerns Mr. Richens has had, and we've asked them to do quite a detailed layout, although it looks like Chinese to most of us, too. It takes the next few years and what you anticipate. But I remember somewhere in the strategy we had talked about partnering with the state of Arizona to try and save some costs and go that route. Have we deviated from that, or is that still part of the plan?
Several years back, we hoped to do some of that, especially when it came to our mainframe, but we could never get the connectivity and the services, and they didn't have the capability of supporting our particular environment at the levels we were at. So we've ceased that because, frankly, we're moving forward well with all the projects to actually turn the mainframe off, so that's become a non-issue. But connectivity is going to always be a big issue in terms of how we are able to transmit that much data at that type of capacity. And we're going to continue to look at fellow cities for disaster recovery. Can we share each other's data centers? All of those type of things. But a lot of it is cost. And I'd be happy to put together some of the stuff we are looking at as well, because I, like you, was saying, well, the corporate must have figured it out. But the stats that I'm seeing is there's very well-publicized examples. But if you look at their total spend and how much of their environment truly is going to the cloud, the stats I'm seeing is not the big numbers everybody thinks. We're doing this in a very cautious, I think, well-planned out manner.
Can we get the cost analysis before we move forward with this item that you did on the outside storage capability? You know, some of the
I can give you an example of one of them that we did related to tape.
Yeah, I'd like to see kind of the methodology, because, you know, when you read through the thing, you know, when you read through the staff report, it gives you a couple of options. We can choose to go out to rebid. Council cannot approve this item. It just seemed like we had a robust suite of choices here. And I think there's a lot more choices out there. I kind of want to see that analysis that you did to understand, you know, how close are we? And, you know, does it make sense now to start exploring it instead of building our own systems in-house, you know? Enough kingdom building. There's a building right down the street on the corner of University and Alma School, AT&T, that does a ton of this kind of stuff. I mean, they host people from all over the world to do data storage and redundant systems and file sharing and all that kind of stuff. So I what's the timeline? Is this like, oh, we have to have this yesterday, or we're going to collapse as a
nation?
This
is one of the things that we pitched last year in the budget process for innovation that we're very concerned about because of these particular systems, document management and the financials. This does not, if we don't go forward with this, we continue to have some of the single points of failure we have today on our document management systems. We also have the ability, we're having a tough time being able to maintain these systems because they're 24/7. What this does is allow us to keep some of the system up while we do maintenance, and then vice versa. We are down to very narrow windows, you know, of 12 midnight to 2 a.m. in the morning to try to maintain these systems, and it's still providing disruption to people who are trying to use the systems. So it's as much about keeping today's work going and keeping things highly available as it is about that, you know, potential outage
so
situation.
So I'm guessing by the time that you order all this hardware and get the space put together and this assembled, I mean, it's, what, 3 or 4 months before it's
Correct.
Up and running?
Correct.
So do you think maybe I could get a meeting to kind of walk me through your methodology and kind
Absolutely.
Of understand? I want to learn more about this, because I know we're spending a lot of money on technology, and I think there's a great opportunity for us to reduce costs when it comes to this with some of the cloud technology that's coming out there too. And so, I mean, if you could teach me a little bit about how that all works and walk me through your analysis, I'd really appreciate that.
Be happy to.
But Councilmember Higgins looks like she'd like to join.
Because part of the issue is the timing. It's a bigger upfront cost, and then the payback is later when you're not having to replace that equipment, as you're talking about. So I'd be happy to.
And remember, you're dealing with a bunch of novices up here who live in a plug-and-play world, you know, where we don't have to think a whole lot, but we see all the clutter. When you watch the commercials on TV, it's like there's this great world out there that's easy, you know, and that corporate accounting is as simple as buying an iPhone. And, you know, that's the world that we're living in. We get it that you live in a world of reality, and we don't as far as the technology. So help us bridge that gap a little bit, a little bit more.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think if you get down to sixth grade level with us, so we can understand.
Speak English.
Because we assume, frankly.
Have you seen those sixth graders?
Okay, fourth grade. No, just so you know where we're coming from, we assume that literally you can just change a thing and flip a switch and all of a sudden everything's wonderful. Because that's what you hear and you read. So we get it that it's not that simple, but we just need that connection. Because we're improving a lot of money and we're willing to do it. I think we'd just like to understand on a more basic level. Is that adequate? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, 4I and 4J. 4K through 5C. 5D through 5K. Councilman Kavanaugh?
On 5J, I think I would ask that be taken off consent right now. I know, and I and several other council members have some questions and inquiries into Mr. Brady and Mr. Rigby on that I think we're hoping to get some additional information on. So for right now, I think it should stay off consent. Thank you.
Okay, 5J is off consent. 5L through 7B. 8A and 8B.
Mayor.
Councilmember Higgins.
I think it's just a typo, but this is, I believe, 8A and 8B is District 6 from the map on my wall, but I could be wrong. So just have a peek. Okay. How's that?
Yeah, we'll take a look at that.
Okay.
I can't understand why they would be confused. It's East Sunland Institute, which is north of East Southern, west of South Ellsworth. I don't know why anyone would get confused by those directions.
I either, but I, you know, the map on my wall, I don't think agrees with that. So
north of East Southern, I like that. Okay.
Thank you.
Take a look at that. All right. Item 2A here: presentation, discuss, and update on DMB Eastmark development.
Mayor and Council, as representatives from DMB come up for the presentation, I'd like to just do a very quick introduction and background.
Mayor, real quick, I'm sorry, apologize. Just to remind the council, we're going to be adding the item on supporting the
budget, the resolution.
Poly, just make sure it's not on here, but it will show up.
It's not on the agenda.
Right, it's not currently on this agenda, but
it will be added.
Be on for Monday.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
I think everyone had a hard copy. The resolution. Everyone had a hard copy delivered to them.
Yeah, just want to make sure
not on
where that we'll be including.
It's
that
not posted yet. It's not posted. Is it online?
It will be this afternoon.
This afternoon.
You need these shirts?
I don't know what they.
Yes.
Mean.
Okay. Sorry. I just want to make sure.
No. Thank you for reminding me.
Try that one.
All right. Now, Mr. Wesley.
Okay. Mayor and Council. A few years ago, we approved what's called a community plan, planned community development zoning district for the large portion of the former GM Proving Grounds, a portion that's owned and being developed by DMB. Part of that community plan and development agreement requests that they come and give us periodic updates on the development, particularly from the economic development perspective. But since a lot of things are happening out there currently, we asked them to expand on that just a little bit this morning and give you an update of the things they're doing. So Karen and Dee and Trevor are here to give you that update. And so I'll turn it over to whoever's going to lead off. And
thank you. Mayor Smith, council members, good morning. I'm Dee McDonald with DMB. With me this morning is Karen Taylor, our executive vice president, along with Trevor Barger, our lead planner with the Espiritu Loci. So we've been given 15 minutes this morning to cover 12 months worth of activity at Eastmark, so we probably need to get going. So regional context, 3,200 acres, located just east of the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. So what's happening? We've been very busy on site over the last year since our grand opening, working on developing the project. These are some images of some of the construction activity on site today. We have seven builders that are poised to open the first 210 acres of residential on the project on June 1st. Those builders include Maricay, Mattamy, Meritage, Standard Pacific, Taylor Morrison, Woodside, and Ryland Homes, which used to be Trend Homes. It's 709 lots. Four of the builders are currently constructing models, and we're a mere 6 weeks away from opening, but we're feeling really good about the fit and finish of the community. As part of our development activities, we've completed construction of about 4 miles of collector and arterial roadway, including the northern half of Ray Road, a portion of Signal Butte Road, and a couple of internal collectors, including Eastmark Parkway and Everton Terrace. So this is somewhat of an eye chart, but this is the Great Park Master Plan that the city approved back in 2011. And the important thing about this collection of parks is that it's a regional park that we are constructing in phases that once complete, we dedicate to the city of Mesa for operation and maintenance. The first phase, which is about 10 acres, includes a lake and stream system. It includes a palm court with a water play area. It includes an amphitheater that can seat up to 10,000 people, along with parking. Integrated into this first phase of the park, and it's our intent in future phases to take the same approach, is we've integrated a private use, which is our visitor center and recreation building that's located towards the center at the bottom of the exhibit. Neighborhood parks, we're also developing actually 12 neighborhood parks as part of this first phase. I would have taken photos of those, but it's a work in progress, so this is a rendering of what those will look like once complete. This is a rendering of the Palm Court, so we're looking northeast up the Palm Court. You can see the water play area at the end of the Palm Court. Obviously, the growth of the vegetation is about 5 to 6 years in the works. To the right is our visitors' rec center building, and in the distance you can see the amphitheater. This is a photo taking of the visitor center and rec building. It's complete. We have a temporary COO, and we're working on FF&E to get it open. You probably heard that we've inked a deal with Basis Charter School. We're very excited about this opportunity. They broke ground on April 1st, the city staff has worked super hard to get these guys through the planning and approval process. They plan to open the school on August 1st with grades 5 through 10, followed with grades 11 and 12 in 13 and 14. In addition to the first phase, and this is, again, somewhat of an eye chart, so you can see the first phase of the Great Park to the right, and then the fire station site that we've coordinated with the fire department. The first phase at the Basis School, so Basis has an option on an additional 4 acres to build a K through 4 school. And so we're optimistic that once they test the program out in Tucson, they'll move to Eastmark and begin development of that in the next few years. So what we're looking at here is the next park in the Great Park. This is the another example of how we intend to integrate the park system with the adjacent uses. And so we didn't come up with this conceptual design until we knew what that use was that was going to be adjacent to it. Then we had a really great idea or good idea as to what we wanted to do. And so although it's very conceptual in nature, we've integrated the retention basin for the school site into the park system. It's actually still a private retention basin owned by the Basis School. In return, Basis has provided us access to the parking lot. And so during non-school hours, residents or the general public can use the parking lot to access the Great Park. And then our ad campaign, you've probably seen some of our ads on TV. We've coined the term synchronicity, which is really about the notion that it's connected transformation. Some of our billboards that we've installed, and then our website's up.
You could say synchronicity limitless. Yeah, we could sort of. Nina liked that. Thank you, Nina. I appreciate that.
Really don't.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead. They're sitting there completely clueless, is what I'm saying. Someone will explain to you later, and you'll be disappointed. Don't worry about it. Go ahead.
I don't know what you're laughing about. And then marketing signage. Some of this signage is installed at the corner of, this actually is installed at the corner of Elliott Road and Ellsworth Road. And then our grand opening. It's been a lot of fun over the last 12 months, a lot of work, but we are poised to have our, at least our first phase of residential opening on June 1st.
All right, thank you, Dee. And I get the pleasure of packing about 6 years of economic development efforts into 5 minutes. And Dee, what he just showed you was really the results of many, many years of planning and now just the last year of construction activity out there leading up to the grand opening on June 1st. But I want to just start out by talking about DMB's commitment that we made to the city back in 2006 and 2007 to economic development. And really focusing on bringing employment users to this, not only our property, but the surrounding area. It's been transformational for our company. Historically, we have marketed to a residential audience and to a retail tenant audience. We've never before, in such a robust fashion, marketed to an employment audience where we can attract large employment users to our properties. So we're very excited about it. It's kind of uncharted territory for us, and in working with some of the national site selection consultants, it's very unusual for them to see a master plan community developer aggressively pursuing industries, in particular employers. So our economic development initiatives over the last several years and as we continue forward will focus on several areas, and it's no coincidence that there's an acronym in here somewhere, starting with healthcare. All DMB communities have a healthcare partner. Eastmark will be no different. We have been working aggressively over the last year to select a healthcare partner for Eastmark, a partner that will grow with us over time and that will not only provide healthcare opportunities and services for the surrounding area, but there will be specific programming embedded in this platform for our residents, the residents of Eastmark. And I would hope to be able to come back and see you shortly because we are very, very close to the selection of our healthcare partner. In addition, education, big, important element of all of our communities. For those of you who are familiar with our communities, schools tend to have the prime real estate in every one of our locations because we believe every great community is anchored by great education opportunities. Dee showed you the basis school. We have a unique situation at Eastmark where we have two school districts that we have worked with, both Gilbert and Queen Creek, and we are hopeful that when conditions warrant, those school districts will be able to participate and provide education opportunities for us. Right now, that's not the case, just because of the demographics and student populations in their existing school facilities. So we really were compelled to go out to the market and say we need education opportunities for our students, for our residents, day one. We did an RFP about a year ago and had very, very good response, and Basis was the first school we were able to land. We're very excited about Basis. As many of you know, they've been named consistently one of the top public schools in the country. So to have them on our site is very important. The one conundrum we have with Basis is they're going to be open in August of 2013 when we don't yet have any residents. So this school will probably be full before we have residents at Eastmark. That's a good problem to have, and we're very, very, very happy to have Basis as our first school. We're also working on some other education initiatives that I'll get to. Aerospace and aviation, this has been
Karen,
some...
Councilman Summers has a...
Yes.
Thank you. When you say charter schools, unless I'm missing it, you got three sites for charter schools. Where's the site for the public school? Because charters are great, but you're still going to have that, the foundation, which is that public school. So is that going on one of these three sites, or is that a separate site?
It could go on one of those sites. The charter schools, what's interesting, typically their footprint is much smaller than the traditional public schools. But we have had, and we've engaged in multiple conversations, in particular with Queen Creek, because our residential development is starting in their district. And they have schools that are not yet at capacity. And so it could be years before they have a need for another school. And we've told them, you know, when they are ready, talk to us, we will find them a site. We don't know where that site will be. They do have a site immediately adjacent to us, to the east of us, so they could pursue, they could build on that site, or they can come back and talk to us, and we'll find an appropriate location for them at the time, at that time. But we don't have one selected today for them.
Okay, but you're planning for that because traditionally they use, you're right, they use a lot more space. They have security concerns that they're going to want to have addressed, and they tend to use a lot of acreage, which I would hope we would encourage them for something a little bit more vertical than the suburban schools have done in the past to reduce that number of acreage.
Absolutely. We have in our other communities, a surprise, for example, our Marley Park School, we worked with the school district and the city to develop the first intergovernmental agreement between the school and the city for joint use facilities. So the sports fields are used jointly between the city parks department and the school. So nobody had done that before. So we definitely will be looking at those types of options. We'd like to shrink their footprint because they're very land consumptive, and we think, just to be consistent with our overall vision for East Mark, that the more compact, dense environment is what we're looking for.
Yeah, and I think for your commercial properties, that template, that theory, holds throughout the, can you, yes, reduce them and convince them to go to vertical, because some of these other potential sites, when we were talking about like the university, that, yes, maybe you don't need 100 acres, you can use fewer and go vertical on that.
Exactly, and I'll jump ahead on that. We, as many of you know, and it's, pretty public, Grand Canyon University is looking for a second location, a second campus in the East Valley. We believe our site is pretty competitive, and we have had conversations with them about doing just that. I mean, do you really need, this huge suburban-like campus, or, would you be amenable to a much more urban-type setting? And so we don't know where that's going to go, but we're certainly trying to push that conversation.
Something like a little bit more like the University of Arizona, where the community is focused on that, but it's an urban campus.
Yes.
Or Harvard.
Or, or a good example that a lot of people know of, George Washington University in Washington, D.C., where you've got a university that's really part of a larger area. It doesn't have a real defined boundary, but it creates a pretty important character for the Georgetown area. Whether we can get to that, we don't know. But we're certainly going to push in that direction.
Well, it's a vision that hopefully changes minds or at least widens their gaze a little bit to see what those possibilities are. All right, thank you.
Yes. So that slide's fine. So going down the list on the aerospace and aviation, as many of you know, we have worked since day one, since actually before we had our zoning, on that industry because of its importance to the city of Mesa, in particular Boeing. From that original kind of concern, if you will, to make sure that we didn't do anything that would hinder Boeing's operational capabilities in the future, we have spent an awful lot of time focusing on that industry because it's something we don't have to create out of whole cloth. The city of Mesa has done a phenomenal job in this industry, as evidenced by all the activity at the airport. Able Engineering is the most recent example. Those are huge wins for the city, and that is a workforce base and an industry base that we intend to continue to focus on. Tourism, technology, obviously we've spent time on that. The economy and market forces have gotten in our way a bit, but we're not going to give up hope on those fronts. But our commitment remains very, very strong to attract these employment users. And I have to commend the city staff in particular, with the willingness and foresight back in 2007 and 2008 to work with us to develop a very flexible entitlement construct that has allowed us so far to be very, very nimble and very responsive to opportunities that have come our way. The graphic in front of you now just depicts the number of opportunities that have come to us that we've responded to. We've spent an awful lot of time developing our relationships with GPEC, the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, the Arizona Commerce Authority, City of Mesa Economic Development staff, so that as these opportunities present themselves in the market, we're able to quickly and nimbly respond. The best example of this, of course, is the First Solar building up in the northeast portion of our property. We were able to, working with the city, we were able to go from a phone call to 1.3 million square feet of manufacturing space in less than 1 year. Where else can you do that? none of the competitors outside of Arizona and really inside Arizona are able to move that quickly. And so that was a direct result of the entitlement platform that your staff and we worked on together back in 2007 and 2008. And we anticipate that that platform will continue to serve us well as these opportunities come to us. Now, we're about to move into the next phase of our overall strategy, and that is not just sitting and waiting for things to come to us, but rather going after them, aggressively pursuing some of these industries and pursuing the site selection consulting world from around the country. People that don't know about Arizona, people who don't know about the Phoenix metro area, people who have no clue what's going on in the Southeast Valley, and then specifically they're not familiar with our property and our ability to move and respond to their needs. So we're going to move into that phase of our efforts, and we're going to not rest until we achieve our mutual goals of landing the big ones here.
Councilor Summers?
Karen, I know you've probably fielded a lot of questions for bullet point number two up there, which is the resort. Obviously, Gaylord's not going to happen, but you've been aggressively pursuing other avenues. Are you able to disclose any of, at least generally, what you're doing for the people watching?
Well, I think just because it's a matter of public record, the incentive package and entitlements for the Gaylord Hotel remain in place. As everybody knows, you know, we all jointly got dramatically impacted by the economy. The business travel convention business just got hit very, very hard in 2009. Arizona, unfortunately, got hit harder than the rest of the country for a number of different reasons that I probably don't need to get into here. But the industry is coming back. It's coming back nationally. It's coming back in Arizona. Unfortunately, it's coming back slower in Arizona. But, you know, there will be a time when it's back because the fundamentals of Arizona and what makes it attractive, in particular to business convention planners, still exist. Our weather, our amenities, everything, all that stuff is still there. And so it's a matter of timing, and we remain cautiously optimistic that that we're going to be able to talk, you know, in the not-too-distant future about a destination-oriented convention hotel.
So without getting specific, you're still pursuing opportunities to
absolutely
meet that plan. The package is still in place, and even though it's not Gaylord, there are going to be other potential suitors that you've been talking to. So we're still moving ahead with this idea.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't rule out the Gaylord brand either.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
So in addition to pursuing the multiple opportunities that have been presented to us, we're also pursuing some fun opportunities as well. For those of you who are familiar with Tough Mudder, we just about a month ago hosted the second Tough Mudder competition. For us, it's very important. We had 10,000 participants and an additional 4,000 spectators. One of the reasons why we worked hard with city staff to get our signage up. It was a great marketing window for us. We had an awful lot of people there. We have a multi-year lease with Tough Mudder. We will move them around our property as development conditions warrant. But it is turned out to be a pretty important event for us.
And after they're finished with the race, you're going to have a reception inside your new visitor center.
Right.
That would certainly leave a mark.
Right. Absolutely.
That is mark. Yeah.
That's right. And so, just when we get down to really the pedestrian or retail business of commercial development, we have engaged consultants to help us really identify today what's necessary. Maybe, you know, not the big employment users that I just talked about, but really how do we provide the retail uses that are needed today to serve our residents that we anticipate here within the next 12 months. You know, the retail users, office users, medical, industrial, and apartment users. And so we are really in the weeds on doing that analysis and the planning of our commercial sites. We have one commercial site that we have been doing an awful lot of planning on at the corner of Ray Road and Ellsworth. We have looked at multiple scenarios. You know, how do we create a place that's not just your typical commercial development? We want it to be very indicative of our commitment to quality and our vision for the community. But we have to do that without breaking all the fundamental rules of retail development. So we've got an awful lot of eyes and planners working on this and hope to bring some finite plans to your city staff here in the relative near term. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions on our economic development activities before I turn it over to Trevor.
Any more questions? Okay. Thank you. And by the way, questions from Summers do not count against your time limit, by the way. So,
Thank you.
Trevor.
To update all of you, thank you this morning again. And I'd like to share with you our planning efforts. So to support economic development, we have two new enclaves of neighborhoods coming together. And these are two exciting additions to Eastmark. We have our what the community plan calls out as development units 8 and 9. We're talking about them as one entity because they divided a little bit differently than we originally anticipated. To do this, we look at the context of the surrounding region. And really, with the airport in place, there's a large commercial block that sort of surrounds Eastmark and the economic development that we're doing, and trying to get our neighborhoods, of course, to emphasize and support that commercial as well, particularly this stuff in the freeway corridor just to the south of DU 8 and 9. Focusing economically on the our eye chart that's in the community plan about creating a center of regional importance, we're focusing in this area on the executives, the exclusivity, the knowledge workers, and really the club focus to neighborhood enclaves. So what we have is an opportunity that rarely occurs in suburban development, this ability to have three very different lifestyles all in incredibly close proximity to each other. So we have in DU 7 the knowledge worker neighborhoods focused around neighborhood parks. Then in the DU 8 and 9, we have two enclaves. One is an executive club, which is a gated, exclusive enclave, and then an active adult enclave. And my mother makes it very clear I have to be very careful when I talk about this category, because at 55 or above, she is in this category, and she has not stopped working. She's very much in the workforce, very much in her prime of doing community service and really being active in everything that goes on in the world. And so this is a group we've been searching for to be able to activate the uses of the Great Park, the civic and cultural uses that come together here, along with being able to have a place for the executives that Karen is attracting to stay and live in the community along with their knowledge workers. All of this focus, and you can see it in the diagram there, the three bright colors pinwheeling right around the first phase of the Great Park. The realignment of Eastmark Parkway from where the CP had it going south to coming more to the east allows us to connect these two club cores right back into that Great Park and really make it the southern end of that experience. So then looking at how that activates other things, just to the south of us, the planning staff would really like to have that a commercial employment use along the freeway there. If this plan diverts things to the east, we activate only one core, or to the west, we activate only one core, doing it as we have shown in the diagrams here. We activate another great core at Signal Butte and the freeway right there. And then in addition to that, I'm sorry, and then going to DU7. So we have these great knowledge worker neighborhoods that we described, the 12 neighborhood parks in the first phase, complementing it for a total of 25 neighborhood parks and about 1,700 knowledge worker homes. To the south, those two enclaves that we talked about, the north of the little loop going through there, which is Eastmark Parkway, is the executive enclave. To the south is the active adult neighborhoods. We'll skip that one, but that's two dramatic pictures of the clubs.
Is that top secret?
Could you bring us a daytime picture?
Absolutely.
I think this was taken at night.
And so looking at really using the clubhouse as the social element of these enclaves to pull these enclaves really tight into the club rather than to individual neighborhood parks, the club providing in the north really a focus on exclusivity, the place to have the holiday party for the corporate execs. In the south, more of the family room, a place to hang out for the active adults to gather and socialize. Both of these have fitness components, multi-purpose rooms, catering kitchens, pool facilities, and event lawns to complement them, but done in different styles. Next. Then we have a open space character that unites all of these together. In the executive club, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what that character is that pulls it together. And in the East Valley, nothing seems to say exclusivity more than a Groves community. And so one of the things we noticed when we were exploring the Groves communities is many of them, as the homes went in, we lost the Grove. Here we don't actually have a grove, so we are installing the grove to be able to do that. And it's the idea of having an open space corridor that allows the grove to continue through the backyard spaces, even when the homes are built and in space, you always see the grove present there.
And when you put the grove in, you might want to put trees that actually have leaves on them, because...
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this time of year, all of the grove pictures look like the ones without the leaves.
Yeah,
without the
well, this might have been a picture you would have preferred to take at night.
That's right. In the active adult community, to provide an entirely different open space experience, the idea here is to have no rear yard walls. So we'll have pool fence enclosures along rear yards, privacy walls around patios, but then wall sort of more the Midwest element of yard to yard, house to house is an open space with the open space corridor running in between it. As walking experience is the highest element in an active adult community, wanting to have a path and trail network to do that. Next. And so looking at that path and trail network, then really linking all of those community elements together and bringing them all very tightly back to the two clubs in the green in the center, and then from those two clubs to the great park to the north there. Again, the image is taken recently, so we're all devoid of the leaves, but trying to pull together those pieces.
Thanks for pointing that out, by the way.
All right. So what we look for models, because this idea of how do you do this in an urban setting right next to a polytechnic, right next to the airport, and so, of course, downtown Phoenix with the Encanto and the Phoenix Country Club. Of course, as Councilmember Summers pointed out, trying to do it on a more compact footprint, and so really pushing to see if we can't do it without golf, really relying on the social element of the club rather than the golf course to provide the exclusivity for these. And the next. For the active adult, really the model has typically been more than a square mile with a golf component and other pieces, and here compressing it down to about 310 acres, taking out the golf component and really making it a more appropriate to its setting, compact format for these sort of elements. Connecting regionally, this portion of the site is we chose specifically because it has some issues connecting to the rest of Eastmark and connecting to the region, which in return make an exceptional opportunity for its exclusivity and protection of the neighbors, the security that's wanted in the active adult, and the gating that's wanted in the executive club. It's surrounded on three sides by floodways that kind of come through the region and a power line corridor that is serving SRP in that area. And so it has a natural sort of boundary that kind of goes in place to give it that exclusivity that we're looking for. Connecting to the greater region to the south, we have that commercial corridor we spoke of, and then just south of there on the aerial, you can see, of course, the employment core. Then continuing further south, this connects us down to Queen Creek along the Signal Butte corridor. So you kind of take Eastmark through the core, then Signal Butte south. It connects us to the high school in Queen Creek. It connects us to Schneff Farm and the olive mills, and then down to the Ironwood Banner Hospital facility to the south. And so we're kind of ringed in, plus our own facilities. Regional connectivity via PATH system, working hard with the planning staff to connect us into the greater East Valley trail system and providing our links along those floodway corridors as a great open space corridor to use as a regional trail system surrounding these sites and connecting us further north and further to the west. So with a wide selection of builders, that's kind of what we have in plan for our next phase of DUs 8 and 9. To do that, we're required by the community plan to declare the character of these neighborhoods at the time of the DUP. And so the DUP, which is before the staff right now for review, and they've given us some comments so far, sort of sets that up. But when we did First Solar's activity, we transferred all of the commercial, which was in a potential core in DU9, up to DU6 to support their activity. As a result of that, we kind of left it unclear about what was to happen here, other than the numbers were now off the table on the budget. And so we have come back with a proposal for an amendment to the community plan to clean up the language of Section 6 to make it more consistent with this presentation.
That it?
That's it.
And as I'm looking at your plan, I don't see a single cul-de-sac on there.
There are just a couple of cul-de-sacs right where the gates of the executive club come in place because of kind of how traffic maneuvers
that's
work.
That's okay. That's good. But two cul-de-sacs for 530 acres. We'll take that. Thank you. Great.
Thank you very much.
That's it? You're not going to show the pretty picture of the monumentation?
How about the last slide?
There we go. Thank you.
Yeah. for our entry statement.
I want to let you show the pretty picture. Palm trees, they always have leaves.
Exactly.
I guess they're called fronds or whatever they're called.
They are fronds.
Okay. Any questions? Fronds. Councilmember Summers.
First of all, I had the opportunity to go out there with some city staff to tour it, and the palm trees look great, actually. So do some of the amenities that are already up. Still very much a lot of dirt being compacted, but it was certainly, you can get an idea of the kind of activity that you're talking about when you have the opportunity to go there. So in the near future, if anybody wants to go out there, I highly recommend you contact them and go. For my question, you had a slide here, second to last slide, 48, that kind of touches on the critical community infrastructure that we're going to want to build on this facility. We have a CIP presentation coming up after you, so I just wanted to get an update on your portion of that community infrastructure, the sites for the civic sites, library, the fire station. I think you put some money into the bank for that, as was the agreement. We already talked on the schools and the park. So can you talk just briefly on how you're doing on the community plan for the civic infrastructure and what's available?
Well, in terms of our commitment to deliver infrastructure for the community, you know, their first phase obviously was Ray Road with all the various utilities that went into it. Ray Road is our sewer solution for about half of the project. As we move north, we have a commitment to contribute to another sewer line that goes into Warner. We've been working hard with SRP to make sure that we've got the appropriate amount of utilities and power to service our power requirements. All of the major infrastructure that we're installing, we've qualified for CFD reimbursement, and so we've actually have a couple of projects that we're starting to compile to come back to the city to look for reimbursement for those improvements. But, you know, the CFD is a beautiful tool for a developer because it provides us an opportunity to advance a lot of infrastructure, regional park improvements, things of that nature, that we would have otherwise had to wait a little longer to do, just because of the economy. So we believe that the city's done a really great job also through their CIP in providing really great infrastructure for the region and for our project. I don't think any of us could sit here today and point out a project that we've worked on where we didn't have an obligation to run 2 or 3 miles of everything to get to a project. And when we acquired this project, we had infrastructure on all three sides of the project. So that really isn't accretive to our ability to develop the project.
Okay. And when we talk about libraries, is there a site here potentially we can place one?
Absolutely. Again, our vision is that civic uses go along the edge of the park, and we figure out a way how to integrate those into the Great Park. And because we have such flexible entitlements, we haven't spotted public, you know, the Queen Creek schools. We haven't spotted library sites. We have spotted the fire station because they wanted.
And I noticed on the fire station too, Alex, you'll love this. They actually put the cutouts for the apparatus. It's already right. Being built into the road.
So
we haven't even designed the fire station. It's going to have to be completely ripped out.
Well,
no, I'm kidding.
A couple of interesting notes on the fire station. When you look at the first phase of the Great Park, you'll notice that the fire station is located approximate to our lake in the Great Park, in the hopes that when you, whatever you do with the hoses in the fire station, test the equipment, clean them out, whatever, you're able to utilize that lake. You'll also notice in the parking lot immediately adjacent to the fire station, the parking lot that will be shared with folks using the park. The city has agreed to allow us to stripe it for basketball courts in hopes that in the downtime for the firemen that they can come out and shoot hoops and attract some of the residents to join them. So we're really thinking through kind of additional layers of social interaction and trying to pull those civic uses into the fabric of our community.
Not a really important question. Natural gas, is this using gas in this neighborhood?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Not our gas. It's Southwest gas.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Finally, first off, thank you very much for your time. But in closing, I would hope that everybody here, everybody on the council, staff, and members of the public that are here today, mark your calendar for June 1st, because we're going to have a fabulous day out there on our grand opening day at Eastmark.
So June 1st, fabulous day.
We will guarantee a fabulous day.
10:00. A wonderful time is guaranteed for all.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next item is peer presentations, multiple. Discuss and provide direction on the fiscal year 13-14 capital improvement program, the bond sale, streets, public safety, CIP, capital improvement programs or CIPs, and Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport.
Capital improvement program.
Segue intro. I did. I heard you. Thank you. Thank you, Councilmember. Okay. Good morning, Mayor and Council. With me today, I'd like to make an introduction. So with me today is Ryan Wimmer, and he is our Deputy Budget Director. So I don't think we've had a chance to introduce him to you. So I wanted to make sure you knew who it was walking around with me. We are going to try to streamline this morning because we do have a lot of important presentations and information that we want to get out to you. So what we're going to do is kind of just hit the highlights on the CIP overview, and then we'll start walking through with some of our departments. We do want to bring up to your attention something that we introduced last year, which is some nomenclature that we're going to use when we start talking about projects. There are three different categories that we're putting our CIP projects into. The first one are funded projects. Funded projects are those items that we have already identified the funding for. Either it is a grant item, it is regional funding, or it is authorized bonds. So it's bond authorization we already have in our possession. The second category are planned projects. These are projects within our five-year time frame. However, they may not have full funding identified. We may have a grant, but we don't have the match, or we need future bond authorization in order to do the project. The third category are future projects. These are the ones that we look out kind of on the horizon, make sure that we're planning for. There are some very large projects that may not be in our five-year, but we need to be looking for them and planning for them. So as the departments come forward with their presentations, you'll see that their projects are divided into these categories as they discuss them. So you can see which ones are already funded, which ones need some type of funding in the future in order to do them, and which ones are planning mechanisms that we're looking for the future. Okay. We're going to skip to the pies. So just give you an overview of the five-year of the funded projects. So this kind of shows you where our funding is over the 5 years right now. Just kind of a pie of where we're doing that. Most of our funding for CIP projects does come from our bond authorization from the citizens during those elections. We also have a considerable amount of grants that we try to use. We try to leverage our money as well as we can by using grants or other sources of funding. Okay. The second slide there, we just talked about, gives you the kind of the numbers of where you can see where our funding is coming from for the total that is funded in the five-year plan. Because most of our funding does come from bond authorization, how does this affect our annual operating budget? It affects us in the fact of debt service repayments. So what we'd like to show you here is what our debt service is estimated. Okay. These are all the debt service payments that we have estimated based on all of our current bond authorizations. So we have not necessarily issued all of this. So one of the issues you have on your April 15th agenda is our 2013 bond sale, approval to go out and do that sale. That is included in here, as well as all subsequent issues of the parks bonds through here. Anything that's been authorized at this point. Okay, and this is, we're just looking at the general obligation debt service on this particular graph here. Okay. The green line at the bottom is our pre-2008. So that is our debt service that we are not using a secondary property tax levy to repay. The blue items are the ones that are the 2008 authorization as well, and then the light blue is the 2012 parks authorization. That shows you those, and those are the ones we are using a secondary property tax to repay. To make it a little bit easier to see, when we take out that pre-2008 that we're still using general fund to pay versus secondary property tax, this shows you how we smooth that debt service, and that way we're able to smooth the secondary property tax levy to the citizens. At this point, that's really all we're going to talk about. Like I said, we're going to try to streamline the presentation for this point here.
And Mayor and Council, can I just make also one point is, remember, we've only been authorizing secondary property tax. We've only done it once. So over time, and generally that's about a 20-year payment. So we would expect that over the next, well, we've got since 2008, going back to 2008, it'll be about 2028, that we'll be back to a point where we'll be paying down most of what was authorized in 2008. My point is we expect that for every 5 years or so, this would continue to increase up to some point into the future. We're early on in the stage. I mean, when you go and look at our survey with other communities, you see we're significantly lower. And a lot of it has to do with the fact is we really only started issuing the secondary property tax back in 2008. So each year, the levy would continue to increase as we move forward in five-year increments is what I'm trying to say, within a 20-year period beginning in 2028. So that you'll begin to see this. This kind of looks like there's a top here, but really this is just a snapshot of what we've done in our first round with secondary property tax.
Vice Mayor? I know we're trying to streamline, but I've had a lot of questions along those lines. I think I'll stash some of my thoughts and just ask, with regard to plan needs, now you mentioned that as the departments come through, they're going to talk about a little bit of that. I think there needs to be a lot more scrutiny about the planned geo bond debt that comes in the future. I'd love to see that go through audit and finance so we can really hash through and find the reasoning and where they're coming from. It's somewhere back on one of these slides, talks about $275 million over the next 5 years of planned geo bond debt. Does that sound right to you?
Now, what that is when you look at your attachment A, mm-hmm. which was the list of all of the itemized list of projects that the departments yes. have come forward and say, in the next 5 or 6 years, these are the things that they see the needs are.
Yes.
That is your first look at those projects.
We're not recommending this is the first request. The conversation we would like to have with council, I don't want anybody in council to believe that we're proposing a $275 million. We're not. What we're doing is a wish list.
This is a first, so thank you. And you're glad to hear this. I've been working on this for days.
Every department is coming beginning today. You're going to be seeing those presentations. You know, really the way to discuss this, too, is to kind of have the discussion about what is the, philosophically, how much are we willing to consider the tax levy should be. You know, you set the budget first, understanding what the needs are, set a budget, and then we try to merge those together. So we've asked the departments to prioritize, but obviously they've given us a lot of different things, but we would never recommend the $275 million. The last time we went in 2008 for geo bonds, we were at
110.
Okay. And so that number started out much higher. So this is just a process of coming through that process. We recognize there's no way that all these would be done. They are just an opportunity to lay out some of the needs or areas that have been identified by the different departments.
Mayor, if I could.
Go ahead.
That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear it. You know, the way it was put into the original, it kind of had a different feel to it, and I'm glad you guys are looking at it. I think, you know, I'll give you my little spiel here since it's kind of been anticipated. You know, we as a council, majority of us took office in 08. We're going into a crashing recession, just on our heels trying to catch up. But with the mayor's good leadership, council support, you know, we kind of took an approach that we're going to put the pedal to the metal. We're going to, you know, punch through this recession. We're going to try and accomplish a lot of positive things. It involves some debt. I think early on, we all went through and looked at what was proposed and pared that down to a reasonable, and we got the support of the electorate, and it seemed like a good strategy, and we have that confidence out there. What we've done is taken advantage of historically low interest rates and some of this debt. We've taken advantage of one-third off building costs. It makes good business sense if I look back and say this was a smart. We're also ready to take advantage of stimulus projects. Mm-hmm. But what I see happening and my concern, and I'm hoping we'll put this through the filters as we go for planned or projected, especially geo bond debt, is changing atmosphere with regard to, the Fed's really suppressing those interest rates, tax-deductible muni bonds, other things like that. Things are changing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the right answer is, but what I'm hoping is that we'll identify some markers in the road as we go down that kind of help guide this council, and what we'll take to the people is what direction we want to go. It may not be pedal to the metal. It may be a different kind of approach. And so I don't know what the answers are, but I'm just wanting to say, help us as a professional staff, see as council members that make the decision, markers, red flags, warning, to make sure we're doing the right thing as far as indebtedness. I know we have, most people don't understand, realize, but we have caps, state law mandated caps or maximums that we can debt ourselves. And so looking at how that, is accomplished, and I look just a little on my soapbox here. I look at councils from decades past and what we're dealing with now with regard to specifically pre-08 geo bond debt, where we're paying it out of our general fund, $20, $30 million at times that could be used for operations. Mm-hmm. So I asked the question, what are we doing now as a council that might impact councils, decades down the road? And I just hope we don't burn through too much of our capacity. My thought is that we leave some ammunition for councils in the future. So that's just kind of thoughts and filters. And, I appreciate how, some of the information is coming across. So.
And Mayor and Councilmember Finder on that, or Vice Mayor Finder on that particular note, when we look at our bonding capacity, we are actually in very good shape compared to all of the other cities in the valley. We are less than 50% of our bond capacity right now.
Yeah, we're just because the way we started out so late and the way we've issued it on the geo bond sides, those state caps have never been something that we've had to worry about bumping up against. And we believe if we take a reasonable approach like we did in 2008, mm-hmm. We will be able to maintain a program that we will build on over the next 20-year program is really what it is, because the idea is that every five years you're having a capital improvement program. It's part of how cities, you think about a city our size, 140 some square miles, 450,000 people, and you look at the growing needs just out at Eastmark. I mean, the fact is we will eventually have to make investments out there, but at the same time, a lot of our major investments you're going to see coming from staff mm-hmm. is keeping up with the aging infrastructure that was invested in back in the 1950s or early, maybe a little bit earlier. So I think about station 203, which you can't even put a pupper in, and yet that's kind of the life cycle of cities. It's very typical for cities every 5 years to review its capital program. Now obviously we have to do that in the context of the levy, the impact on the homeowner, so we manage that process. But at the same time, I think it's important for council to see the large picture of whether it's public safety, communication systems, whether it's fire stations in replacement of fire stations or older fire stations, or keeping up with the growth. I think we've done a good balance of that. We saw a great support from our community on the parks area as a quality of life issue. As soon as we've done that $70 million, the first thing I'm already seeing is there's more neighborhoods that want more parks. They hear about those lists. Right, Mr. Kavanaugh? We've got neighborhoods that are already asking for more parks now. So we recognize it's a balance. This is a discussion. We think it would be good to have the whole council involved because it affects every district in a different way. You're going to have the districts on the far east side looking at how it affects growth. You have the districts on the west side trying to figure out how do we maintain streets that have been invested in a long time, and how do we replace public safety infrastructure. All those things, I think, affect every district in a different way.
Go ahead, Vice Mayor.
Well, I was just going to say, adding to that, in our audit and finance coming up, the first big bullet point is debt service impacts utility rates. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with regard to GEO, but also our utilities and then how much people are paying. But, you know, I appreciate the discussion and where we're going with it. You know, the way it was on the PowerPoint left an impression that planned by professional staff is $275 million. So we have a different, I appreciate the different definition of that.
We will delete that slide. That slide's probably not a good slide to have. Okay. Matter of fact, just take that slide out.
I think we've established that.
That slide should not be created. Well, because when we have the departments come to you, I don't want to focus so much on the cost right away. I want to focus on the priority and the need, and then we need to have a discussion about looking at, again, we have to look at this over a 20-year period from 2028, and recognizing every 5 years, we're going to be increasing that levy. So it's not what you're comfortable with today, it's what you're comfortable we've got three more times to come to the council or go to the community before we're getting to a point where the debt that was issued in 2028 will start coming off the books.
And one quick filter I hope we put it through is council strategic initiatives. What we sat down and said, hey, for this council, we're going to be here for probably four more years. And what we said was the strategy and how that bond debt, you know, meets those goals. So I'm hoping that. Thanks, Mayor.
No, and that's to echo. I think the one thing we've looked at is as we invest, we want to get a return for that investment. Two things. Number one, we want to be strategic. The reason we invest in the gateway area is because we see the real economic return to the community as a whole, not simply to provide sewer service to an Eastmark. I mean, I know that that's not how we approach it, but the investments we've made there, such as Ray Road, such as State Route 24, have been very strategic, and they will provide returns. I think it's how we have to start looking at it, because the fact of the matter is we have limited resources. We will have limited resources. The other thing I don't want to get into is sort of the purchase a car approach, where you walk into the dealership and the first question is, what kind of payment do you want? I hope we start looking at what do we really need to do to both strategically invest and also then invest in new assets, but also in our aged assets to bring them up to speed. And then let's analyze what the cost is, and then we can decide if that's an investment we want to ask our taxpayers to make. And I think all too often we say, oh, we have capacity, let's spend it. I think that's what Alex was getting at, is that I don't think we feel comfortable with that approach. I would much rather say, not the wish list, but here's a priority, as Mr. Brady said. As we prioritize that, let's put it in line with the council's strategic initiatives. Let's look at where we can get the most return or the greatest need, and then we can figure out, okay, I don't like to use the word afford, because we are very, very conservative as far as debt limits in this city. And one slide that I hope that during this overall conversation we bring up again is the one which Chuck used to bring to us, which compared the communities with our percentage as it relates to other communities. And sometimes it's not an apples to apples, but I think on debt load as a relation to state limits, that's a pretty good comparison. And I'm assuming that we will be very, very favorable as it relates to especially our East Valley neighbors, where many of them are close to or right at their state mandated debt limits, and we're not even close. Now, that doesn't mean we run out and spend it, but that just means that we keep it in context to where we are. So.
Correct. And when we say we're less than 50%, that's really because our assessed value is still declining.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would be much lower than that, because our debt is going well, up
and Mesa is not, as far as assessed valuation, we're an average community,
exactly.
Because we don't have a nuclear power plant, commercial nuclear power plant. We don't even have a power plant. So we don't get that windfall that a lot of us. We don't have our downtown with gigantic high rises. We don't get the windfall that some communities get. We're just a peanut butter and jelly bread, and so we make the most of what we have, and I think we've done a great job of keeping our debt level, even when we don't get the benefit of these heightened assessed valuations like other communities do. We still keep it fairly low. So really, when you look at it, we do a much better job, I think, and have for many years, even before this council certainly was seated, because we don't get those spikes. We don't get the other communities, you know, mansion price per square foot on their houses and things like that. And yet we still have a lower debt ratio than they do. So I'd like to see that continue.
Yes, we'll have that.
While still investing. I think one thing we did well in this downturn is we didn't shy away, as the Vice Mayor said, we didn't shy away from making investments. We recognize that this is a long-term process, and you can't run away and hide just because you're in a recession. You've got to look to the long term and recognize that those investments will reap benefits down the line. They'll also incur costs down the line. So, Councilor Summers, I think you had a comment?
Just briefly, as we start to go through the CIP process, I want to make sure that we utilize the lens of the strategic initiatives and how this city has fundamentally changed how it operates, how it thinks about problems, how it's organized. From libraries to policing, fire, every department, Mr. Brady, you've been involved with it, has changed the way they've approached business, fundamentally changing those things. And so what I don't want us to do is slide back into traditional models that may not represent where the city is going based on those changes. We've done some very innovative things, and I think that if we are going to request funding from our voters for the CIP projects, they should really support those new models, not the old one, unless we make a conscious decision to switch back. And as we go through some of these CIP presentations, I think we'll have some questions on that. Thank you.
Let's go to slide 17.
Okay, yeah, because you got 26 slides, and we've taken up your time.
No, we're not going to. This was.
Let's
just review the sale, the bond okay. sale. So you have slide 17 there. Pull it up. Does everybody have that? There you go. Why don't you walk through the bond sale slides?
Oh, okay. These are the bond sales that are on your April 15th agenda. That was reviewed this morning. There are two bonds. This is the approval to go out for a bond sale. What this will do is we will actually go out and do those request those bids, and then we'll be back in May with the results, where we will have a special council meeting, to approve those. We have two sales that we're looking at. The GO sale is just under $60 million. It has bond authorizations of the 2008 still. And then we're also, this is our first sale of the 2012 Parks bonds that will be in there as well. And we've also put how much is remaining. This will, in essence, deplete the 2008 authorization. We'll have $1.5 million left in the public safety, but we'll completely deplete the streets authorization with this particular sale.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Just an observation reading in the paper, Mesa Public Schools sold their $46 million in bonds. If it's accurate, they said their average interest rate is 2.17%, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought that, and that is going to translate. So can we anticipate maybe the excitement of something like that, or is it they just... No, it's a whole apples and oranges, sounds like.
And on the better side, I think my money market account had 0.0217% interest earning. Yeah. I think I actually pay them to keep my money now.
Why don't you review the utility sale?
And then the utility sale. I have to find it, I'm sorry.
Isn't that
21?
On 21. Okay. Utility sale that we're looking at. We're looking at a total sale, authorization to sale at just over $47 million. This is a combination of the bonds that were authorized in both the 2006 authorization, which we still have some wastewater bond authorization from the 2006 election, and then also the 2010 election. What we've included on here, just so that you know where we are in our bond authorization programs, is not only this, how much we're selling this particular issue, but what our remaining authorization is. So if you look on our electric system, after this sale, we would have $3.3 million left in that particular authorization for electric. And then you show the other ones as well. Our wastewater will still have a little bit of their 2006 authorization, so that's been really good. Again, what this shows is even though we may have bond authorization from the citizens, we only issue bonds for projects on an as-needed basis. So if there were
I'm
projects
assuming
that
during, with each of these departments, they'll tell us what they will use.
Exactly.
Or what those might, because I know wastewater, for example, we get the plan upgrades, which we've deferred, and which I'm assuming is still a big part of that $39 million or whatever it was that was included in there.
That list, I think those list of projects were in that. They're in the.
They're in the list. Okay, yeah. They're in the appendix. That's right. I'm sorry.
So how do geo bonds work? I mean, basics of when you go out for authorization is when they say, oh, this is what the interest rate is.
Mm-hmm. No, so wait. Authorization, no, for sale.
For sale.
Not
right.
Authorization.
Yeah, the other way.
They're,
right.
They're authorized.
Authorization goes out to the citizens
right.
for the dollar amount.
Right.
And then each year when we are anticipating to do a sale, we actually go out and bid those bonds.
Right. And so then, as Council Member or Vice Mayor Finter had said, depending on how the bigger federal scheme goes with mm-hmm. tax-exempt muni bonds will change the way our interest rates might be.
That's correct.
Okay.
They will. They can affect that.
Good. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
So that's when we come back to you in May, then we'll actually have the results of that and tell you, and that will be when we know when the actual interest rates would be.
Okay. So if we're we're clear on the sale.
This is actually the one unique sale we do each year from a competitive standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
We negotiate our underwriting and go to market with those underwriters on all the other sales that you've been doing this year. This year it's competitive, so we're going to be at the mercy of the market and the competition of the underwriters. So we're going to do those bids on May 16th. You'll approve those results on the 17th. So this is a little bit unique. So we're actually, what is happening in the market those days?
All right. So what I'm going to propose, Council, is let's, I know we've got a lot of groups teed up, but because I know I can bring back all the other ones any other day, I'd like to invite the Gateway staff to come forward and make their presentation, because they're here today specifically for their program. And have them make a presentation, and then we'll see how much time we have to keep, because we do still have an executive session we need to do.
Yeah, now, I mean, in the past, and did you want to handle the CIP separate from the department budgets?
Yes, because
in the past we piggybacked it.
Well, yeah, but we did that as an update of where we were okay. with the what's already been authorized, but because this is considering the package of
gotcha.
Are we going to consider going forward with an package in November?
Okay.
We thought we'd be good to see it kind of all together, or at least in a package of CIP. There will probably be some departments that will still present. For example, the library is not ready to go today, but we thought we'd at least let them talk about future CIP needs, whether it's this November or sometime in the future.
Okay.
But let's have the Gateway staff come forward and make that presentation right now. And Mayor, I don't know if all the members of the City Council have had a chance to be introduced to the new Executive Director out at the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, Jane Morris. I'd like to welcome her.
Good morning.
So, and Casey's here with us too, so we appreciate them both being here to make this presentation. I've asked them to bring this to the Council because we just talked about strategic plans, initiatives. This was one of the, you recall, this was the one strategic initiative this year that was the highest rated, I guess is the right word, by the Council in our discussions. And so the airport's been working on some significant long-term plans, but we wanted them to break it down into a phase of what, in timing with our contemplation of a bond election, where the city and the airport might join together to begin preparing for the growth of the airport. So with that, Jane, I'll let
Thank
you,
you
start.
Thank you. And good morning, Mayor and Council members. It's fun to be on this side of the table. I've watched you from the TV for over 16 years. I am a District 1 resident, and it's exciting. We have exciting times for us and appreciate your time today. And with me is Casey Denny, the Deputy Director, and the two of us putting together our heads on what we've done in the past and then our vision with your help for the future. The four things we'll cover briefly is basically what we are today, what our future projections we think look like for passenger growth, how we can accommodate that in our initial recommendations to you. For us to just track these key components in front of you is the airport aerial. are one of our most important assets is those three yellow lines, which are our runways, which bring people to and from Mesa from across the world. Great potential in those runways. Starting in the top left corner is our general aviation area, where we have very successful businesses, and we also have some opportunities for new businesses. Moving south from that is the West Terminal. Casey will go into a little more detail on that. Below that is our South Industrial Area, 300 acres of undeveloped land ready for us to help bring jobs to the East Valley. And then swinging around to the east side, the scale of that east side site is 700 acres. And to give you a perspective, that would be like rebuilding our Mesa downtown area. So huge potential there. I'm not discounting the great work that you have done to date to bring us Ray Road, State Route 202, and then the future State Route 24. Excellent assets for us in place, State Route 24 coming in at the end of the of November. Segueing to where we're at today, Casey.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. So passenger service today, it's exciting to look back. It just started just over 5 years ago, back in October 2007. We launched with Allegiant Air, one airline, 13 cities, which exceeded our expectations on the launch. In that first year, we were able to do about 360,000 annual passengers, which again exceeded what we expected to do in that first year. It's grown tremendously since then. We've been very fortunate to then be able to add two additional carriers, Frontier and Spirit. And today we have about 40 nonstop cities. In addition to that, Frontier connecting through Denver, as well as Spirit through DFW, Chicago, O'Hare, and Denver connects us essentially to the world through other connecting flights. In 2012, passengers grew to just under 1.4 million, which made Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport one of the fastest growing small hub commercial airports in the United States. And it's been a tremendous growth. We've been able to do that because of the expansion on the west side, the West Terminal area. It was always envisioned that that would be a startup facility. And when we first built it, it was just a modest conversion of an Air Force building, about 23,000 square feet. We've had to expand that three times in the last 5 years, in addition to three remodels. So not just expanding it, but reconfiguring the interior as well. We're about to start construction on our fourth expansion. And when we get to that fourth expansion, we'll be done with that by the end of this year in November. That will be our last reasonable option to expand the west side. We will the site is constrained. We've always known this. I think that what has surprised us is is how quickly we've gone from startup to build out on the west side. So it will be in a period of about 6 years. We have in addition to the one expansion that will be completed this year, there's some little tweaks that we can do to squeeze out more passenger activity, but it's essentially a locked site.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Quick question. How are you paying for that expansion? Are you debting? Or I seem to remember that the airport authority doesn't have much bonding or debting capacity.
Right. Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Finter, we've been very fortunate for the expansion of this side to fund it through grants. Predominantly, it's been through FAA and state grants, local funds as well. Some of the member contributions to the authority have gone to it. But the vast majority has been about $40 million over the six-year period. The vast majority of that has been federal grants.
Well, and I guess starting this year when operationally we're pushing or basically going to be break even, our annual contributions from the cities, from the participating cities and the Gila Rivers, go almost exclusively to capital programs.
Correct.
And they put in our, most of these are, we're maybe 5% when you take federal and state.
Correct.
Our ability and, our not ability, our requirement.
Our match.
And so all of what we put in now does not go to fund operations or will not go to fund operations. And actually only a small portion was going for the last few years, but will fund our portion of the capital.
With that investment, because we have been able to do it just in time, the economic impact of the passenger service activity today is, well, excuse me, in 2010 was measured at about $700 million a year. So in terms of every flight landing out at Gateway, just under $30,000 per flight economic impact is what we've been able to generate from being able to expand the terminal.
The next slide combines two thoughts. One is the projected forecast of passenger service. So blue is actual, black takes us into a forecast. This is unconstrained. It means that there is a traveling public and there is an airline that will provide the service. The color is new for you today. As airport staff met with me and we started talking about the west side, we wanted to explain that this is a capacity that over time starts from a level of service that would be reflected in the green, and then as we put more people in that west terminal area and the roadway, your level of service starts changing from a traditional stoplight of a yellow, and then at some point we get to red. So it's not a cliff that you immediately fall off of. It's a progression of level of service. As Casey talked about, we feel there might be some minor tweaks to make the west side work, but in the long term, it is not the right place for us to grow the type of passenger service that we think the EastMark team that was talking to you earlier and all the future development plans in and around us, the west side is just not going to work for us long term.
You would have to cover up all those just plain easy signs.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, that is one of our important strategic initiative is to keep just plain easy for this airport as well, and the new site. The long-term vision that this council has had and the East Valley community has had, we've been planning moving to the new site since the base takeover in 93. We've done a variety of studies to help us get ready. The most notable you've heard is called Gateway 2030. That's a plan that tells us that east side site, that 700 acres, is excellent for our future growth. We do not see any fatal flaws with it. Roadway works. The challenge that we look at in the future is financial. Go ahead. So you'll probably remember this is the first phase of that study. The estimate in the plan was $344 million for this. So remembering what Casey talked about earlier, the West Terminal, you know, in a bite is about $40 million. So this phase to move to the next side, we really need to work carefully on how to phase that transition. Go ahead and click the next slide. So some of the steps that the team has been starting on and then I've jumped on and helped move those efforts along, getting on board a program manager consultant, looking at air service strategies. As I said, just having the gates doesn't help us. We need the air service to complement that. So the strategies to support the new site, and then working with the city manager and Mesa staff, what is that first step that makes the site accessible? We have a power line floodway on one side, and we have Ellsworth Channel on the other. So really, vehicle access to this site from Hawes and Ellsworth, and then moving a channel. Go ahead to the next slide, Casey. So this is a tough eye chart, but what we have been talking about is on the top of your screen is 202. That blue rectangle is Hawes. Today it's a two-lane road. We need to bring that up to the roadway curbs that will meet the future demand. We need a bridge over the floodway there, which is that green circle at the bottom of the blue triangle. That is a bridge, and that is, again, the key to accessing this site. We have no way to get to this site off of Ray Road. Moving to the right, there's a pink dashed line. We have Ellsworth Channel that bisects the site, and it basically strands 70 acres tucked in behind State Route 24, and we would recommend that we move that channel to unleash 70 acres of access so that the channel is out of our way and you can access those 70 acres from Hawes, Ray, or Ellsworth. And then finally, the package we think on this initial includes the right amount of water, wastewater, roadway, and fiber connections back to the city to make the site ready to get ready, if that's I don't know that that's a technical term, but it is that first step that gets us access to the site so that we can move on to the next phases. And then the last slide, working with city staff and our consultant team, this is a very trimmed down package of the top components that we think would be extremely helpful for the airport to stay on track to be ready for the next phase of development as we move through the the air service planning and the terminal planning for the new gateway site on the east side. I'd be happy to trying to spare you a lot more detail. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Vice Mayor.
So what you're saying is if we can invest in the infrastructure surrounding that site, that prepares you for hopefully, I thought I heard about $1 billion eventually worth of building and build up out there. Is that about right?
Mayor Smith and Councilman Finter, or Vice Mayor Finter, yes. It is over time, and that could be a 30 or 40 year window. That's the perspective from the aviation side. And then there's probably equal in non-aviation development that the site could also support, which includes office, hotel, retail. It's a site that is big enough for not only the airport but other non-aviation related development.
And again, that $1 billion of future improvements comes from FAA, right? And fees and others, that wouldn't be the city's obligation, I'm assuming.
Mayor Smith and members of the council, the financing package is truly one of the most important things for the team to work together on. The grants at this level are probably not sufficient to do the kind of work that we need to do to bring the first phase to Gateway. Some of the other components would include our own revenue. As we've talked about earlier, we're about in the break-even stage, looking at revenues to date, which parking, rental cars, retail concessions. We think the airport can also provide a revenue source to that future expansion. The other aspects that we need to look at are our airline partners. What can they bring to the table? The ones that are here today or the ones that might be there in the future? And those pieces we would pull together and come back to you and talk through those. And that's the strategy really for the next 12 to 18 months is bring that financing package together so we can see how to do these phases to get to the other side as the slide talked about in the, you know, in the short term, within 10 years.
And I think what I'm hearing you say is that as far as the airport, not these these are really on-site type things, but the airport, the terminal, those types of things, we're going to have to get creative.
Yes, we are.
Because the traditional sources of the FAA coming in, putting in hundreds of millions of dollars in grants, money just not there, and it's not going to be there. So we'll have to get creative in how we do that.
And so, Mayor, that creativity requires, as we've found, sometimes we kind of prime the pump.
Yeah.
To allow that creativity to happen from the private sector or other public partners.
Yeah, I mean, the airport, we haven't used that, but it could involve public-private partnerships.
So everything's on the table. We're not saying we're not going to go to FAA and push
right.
And pull, saying this is one of the fastest-growing airports that needs the support. But what we're really presenting to you today, it says we have this, we think this is an incredible vision. I mean, 700 acres is a lot of development opportunity. And then again, just moving the boundaries of the drainage area frees up 70 acres. So we see this as with the growth you just saw earlier today that's happening in this area. We need to be strategic in how where we invest in the infrastructure in this area so that and this would probably be one of those programs that would be in a 5-year program kind of sitting at the back end of it, doing all the planning. There's a lot of planning, environmental reviews that have to happen, but the idea is to position ourselves so one, we can meet the future needs of the airport. We don't want to be in a position where we're turning away airlines because we don't have gate space, but we also want to be in a position where we can really promote this site to others who may be willing to come in to put in the economic development components of that. And I think without having access to the site, which is really what we're doing here, is getting to the site so we can bring others on in this first phase. That's kind of how we're trying to be strategic in how we're approaching this. We're not looking at this as this $350 million project right now. We're trying to say, what do we need to do right now just to get onto the site, bring development on, public, private, federal, state, whatever it is, partners.
And actually, this is actually about the fourth phase of this long-term deal. You know, you had the widening of Ellsworth, which was joint project. You have the Ray Road, which also brought sewer and water to that side, and then State Route 24. So this is actually the fourth phase of the prep of that east side to get it ready. And Councilmember Summers said, "You okay?
You got it.
Okay. Yeah, so we're not starting from scratch here. We've made significant investments and all those leading up to setting the stage so that however we might pay for that shift. And we're going to have to, and this is one thing that, excuse me, and as we were meeting with Allegiant, for example, at one time, you know, Allegiant loves where we are because it's just plain easy. And what we were explaining to them was that in many ways, our challenges on the West Side Terminal have nothing to do with ramp space or with terminal space. The fact is that Sossaman, most people don't realize, did not exist on the Air Force Base. That was something that the city put in after they took over the Air Force Base. It was never designed to be a major arterial because it had to accommodate the existing infrastructure, which is why you see it sort of winding around. And as you go south on Sossaman, to the chagrin of Queen Creek, who would love to see a lot more traffic go through there, it simply is not set up to handle massive loads of traffic. The other thing is it happens to go through two college campuses, which bring their own challenges and traffic by themselves. And as both ASU Poly and Chandler Gilbert grow, and they're both growing like weeds, you know, that just throws all this traffic into a place that was never set up, nor physically could we create a situation where we can cram all those people in. So in many ways, our bigger challenges on the west side have little to do with the gates and have a lot to do with how you get to the gates. And that's something that the airlines didn't fully understand before we said it. I said, guys, we can park your planes. We can get people through TSA. We can't get people to the terminal because once we start hitting these big numbers, we've created a logjam there's a bottleneck there. We just simply can't get the cars and the people in anymore in an effective manner. So we've got to go to the east side at some point, which is set up to handle those kind of traffic flows. Unfortunately, the terminal isn't on the east side. It's on the west side. So we have this conundrum of these barriers to growth, which go far beyond, I think, the terminal itself.
And Mayor, I think we ought to, and I think Jane said it earlier, and I'll just emphasize one more time, when we see these numbers, this isn't just about the east side terminals. This is about we said a whole new Mesa downtown development opportunity on the east side, in addition to the terminals.
That's the other thing. We don't have room to take full advantage of the commercial growth.
Right.
We have all that industrial land to the south. We don't have a whole lot of empty space for true commercial growth that could play off of the terminal and play off of the commercial. We're done on the west side. We're about filled up because with the options that others have, even to the north, we don't have enough space. So, and virtually no space for a office or a large company who wanted to come in and take advantage, like you see around Orange County, which we often use as an example. Those kind of things. Councilor Summers.
I'll make a brief comment. We, at our public meeting yesterday for This Is My Mesa, which is our rewrite of our general plan, we had one gentleman, great debate, his concern about the airport, how that fits in, how that particular piece is fitting in to the community at large, particularly the housing that exists there already. So the two parts of this is, one, he was concerned about how much investment is going on and how many jobs we have. And I hope he's watching this meeting because his question is really answered in this presentation. One, that we are very careful with how we put this infrastructure in. And, yes, it is an investment by our community in this region in the hopes that we will and in the plan that we will see significant job growth and investment in this community. But unless we are willing to invest in that critical infrastructure, the IT, the roads, the waters, the sewer, the moving of the airport, we won't see the high-wage, high-check jobs that he was so eager to see. So I think this presentation is fantastic. But as a point of direction, it would be appreciated as we talk about This Is My Mesa to see the airport come to some of these meetings, particularly the ones who are in District 6. Those are the folks who are very much concerned about it, and talk about how the plans for this airport, the jobs, the flights. So there's always questions about airport noise, the flights, the economic development, the infrastructure investment that we're making, how this ties in to our general plan and ties into the future of Mesa. So that would be great if we can have the airport folks get actively involved in that process. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
So, Mayor, what I would recommend is we just do, maybe we could do one more CIP presentation.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is invite communications to come forward. This was the highest ranked priority for both public safety departments is the investment in the communication system. So maybe, Randy, if you could just come and move quickly through your presentation.
Morning, Mayor, members of the council. Randy Thompson, Communications Administrator. And this morning I'm here to cover the capital improvement projects for communications. First, a quick recap on 2008. This is a list of some of the projects that we completed. Excuse me. From the 2008 public safety bonds. We have one that's still in progress, one that's not on the list but deserves its own slide is the new site up on Thompson Peak, which is our major backup site for the city. That was done jointly with the Department of Public Safety.
Councilor, help me out with this. Is that picture of the Thompson Peak? Is that part of the Topaz system?
Yes,
or City of Mesa General, does it cover everything? I mean, 800 megahertz, 700?
That's our primary backup site for the city and for wide area coverage.
Okay, and then just out of curiosity, Topaz is one regional system. The county has a system. Phoenix has a system. I mean, how much
ADOT
duplication? What's that?
DPS.
ADOT. Thank you.
Well, ADOT and DPS. Is ADOT, well, include DPS and ADOT?
I guess so. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It was my understanding DPS. The county was even going to do a system. I mean, how much? We talk about how much money we spend. How much duplication of effort is there? This is a backup system to our system. Phoenix has a system. The county has a system. ADOT has a system. How much for a regional community, how much duplication of effort is there in putting in some pretty expensive infrastructure?
There is clearly overlap between the different systems. For example, up on Thompson Peak, there is an overlay site for the Regional Wireless Cooperative. And obviously we have our site up there.
Is there opportunity to share some of this infrastructure so that we're not having one of our towers next to their towers next to ours doing much of the same thing? I mean, there's significant investment here. There's other impacts as well, visual impacts of these kind of things. And I just wonder if how much overlap is necessary.
The good news is from the standpoint of the towers, we share tower space. The county has a tower up on Thompson Peak. This tower has not only the our equipment, but the Regional Wireless Cooperative equipment and the ADOT site, which DPS uses.
So we are using that. So instead of having everybody build another tower,
right,
we are cooperating, working on the same towers.
One tower hanging.
That's what
each person hanging
that's
their
what
own equipment on.
This was the prime example of that. We kind of led the way in helping bring all that together.
Do we get paid like and RWC pays us a fee, a rental lease space, lease spend every month or something like that?
DPS is actually the landlord up there, but I typically for government entities, we don't charge rents back and
forth. We figure that we use their space, they use our space, that type of thing.
Yes, in kind, right.
And it's not just the Thompson Peak site. I mean, there's a lot of different sites throughout the community. And
so if you recall last week, I think that was what one of the things that Mr. Cross mentioned, that part of that joint effort is they're talking. That was one of the topics that I think they're working on, is how to make sure to avoid that redundancy in those areas.
Correct. So it literally is as easy as flipping a switch. But more than the technology side, there's a governance side to this thing that I think also could use some consolidation, which would help us with this technology piece. All right. Thank you.
By the way, we're down a minute.
All right, as far as plan...
Just walk out.
As far as planned projects, we have five to bring forward to you. One has to do with updating of radio equipment at those some of those sites. Reliability enhancement to the radio network. A fiber optic continuation of the build-out of fiber optic connectivity to not only radio communication sites, but the other public safety facilities that don't have fiber optic connectivity, and then some improvements to the infrastructure at the communications facility and the infrastructure for a VHF fire network. Thought I'd start with a brief picture of or example of a radio system where we have various radio sites. We have handheld or portable radios communicating to those sites. We have vehicle-mounted or mobile radios communicating to those sites. We have radio dispatch consoles that communicate over the system. And as you can see here, radio sites, when I talk about those, typically have an antenna and some sort of equipment building. Those buildings typically contain base stations, which allow the communication with the portable and mobile radios that are out in the field. Which leads us to our first project, which has to do with updating obsolete radio base stations. We have 154 radio base stations at 10 radio sites that are going to be in need of updating. The hardware support is ending on that next year. We do currently have enough spare equipment in our stock to continue to operate through 2016 at the failure levels we've been seeing. There is in a few more years an end to the vendor software support. And then some of the reasons that we need to update these is to avoid some of the problems that result if we have failures. I think it's important to note that whether this stays, this system stays as it is, or there's some other governance that's put in place, this same infrastructure and this same updating is going to be required no matter what happens there. It's consistent with what's being used by other and other operations. Yes. The next project, as you saw from the prior diagram I had there, if the core site fails, the communication to all of the radio site sites fails, and that means that the communications to the portable and mobile radios fails. So one of the ways to avoid having an outage like that is to have a second core site in place.
Where's our core site now?
It's located in the communications building.
Okay, that's on sixth
place.
We didn't say where on sixth.
Across from the Cubs headquarters.
The second core site would allow the communications to continue uninterrupted if we were to have a failure of some sort at that site. We would put that at a different geographical location. That would certainly mitigate the risk of a complete failure of the network. Again, this would be consistent whether or not we remain with the current governance or if there were to some changes take place in the future.
And you would consider that at a different city site, like maybe out at the East Side Service Center or something like that, a different power grid and a different place like that?
Yes, okay. We'd take all those into consideration.
Vice Mayor?
I may have missed it, stepped out for a minute. So is this the same as talking about a redundant dispatch center?
No, this is
just the hardware equipment? Are we looking at going towards a dispatch center? This sounded awful familiar.
I think this is not necessarily the dispatch. That's a bigger, longer, more expensive option. I mean, I guess in an ideal world, ultimately, that would be great to have, you know, that, but I think as we start, this kind of goes back to the first part of our conversation about where does the numbers go, and then for me, it's not just the capital on that side, but it's standing up an entire separate dispatch by itself could be a challenge. I think what I've asked Randy to consider is if something were to happen, we've not had, you know, we've been able to work with Phoenix if ours goes down back and forth, but is there a solution that allows us to have equipment so that if equipment fails, then we in a other location we can move the people and go to another and stand up another dispatch, as opposed to the redundancy of the personnel, which is, would be the ongoing really difficult financially for us. But if we could find a way to have equipment set up as a backup, then like whether it's the East Side Service Center or whatever, then we could we move our dispatch services and personnel to another location, stand it up quickly.
Okay, I appreciate that. I, you know, that seems, that's a different way that also the EOC, there was talk about if you did a redundant dispatch area, then have the emergency operations center. And so I'm just
all those would be.
So you're saying not have a second center that's staffed and up, but have a second physical site that could be up and running. Possibly.
And I'd love to have that. That'd be the optimal. That'd be the, you know, the highest opportunity. But realistically, can we afford to operate a secondary one? Probably would be very difficult. But if we could at least have the backup capabilities, equipment-wise is what I guess, infrastructure-wise, so we could, if we had, like this last time where we had an exhaust problem within the facility, and it wasn't an equipment failure, it was just the human, you know, we couldn't have people in that environment. Could we literally move them, the people, to a location where the equipment was already available for them to plug in and go from there? That's trying to come up with options, you know.
I was in Tokyo last year. I didn't realize Tokyo is the most disaster-prone city in the world. It's subject to earthquake, volcano, tsunami,
cyclone,
and local flooding. Cyclone flooding, local flooding, and all those happened in the last year. I mean, they have their emergency center is incredible. And they took us, though, to their backup. They have another center, and it's not a duplicative center. But this is the city that actually deals with these things literally on an annual basis. And what they had was a hall, which was exactly what you were talking about. And they explained to us how, when you looked at it, it was basically just a big hall. And they said, oh, and by the way, if the center we were in an hour ago goes down, within X minutes, we can have this up and going. And they showed us a picture as to when, during one cyclone, they actually set this up as the duplicate thing. So it was wired, but it didn't function as that. It functions as a backup in case the first one went down.
And remember, it was pretty interesting. We're providing dispatch not just for Mesa. Yeah. We're providing for a whole region.
Yeah. So I saw how that can work when you get to have a dual use. And this was basically just used as a hall where they had meetings and conferences and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden, boom! They went and plugged in a few computers to this, and before you knew it, it was the backup system, or backup center. Councilor Summers?
Yeah, let's put this in the context of our strategic initiatives, and one of those strategic initiatives of this council is regional leadership. This one fits that absolutely perfectly, and the example that the mayor has given about Japan really fits this community pretty well. We have police and fire organization that work very well together when you compare it to a lot of other communities across the country and even globally. From a communication standpoint, we've talked about this. Phoenix has their dispatch center and their regional players. Mesa has its dispatch center, huge regional players. Making sure that those systems are integrated, that they can back each other up, that they can act as redundancy will help spread that workload, ensure the public safety from a regional perspective, and make sure that the governance and the operations, the folks who are the boots on the ground providing that service, have the necessary IT infrastructure and the information that they need to do their job. Because Mesa and Phoenix work together on the ground, making sure that this IT is in place and can back each other up goes to a lot of, really will make this a safer community, and I think this particular CIP bond package should be looked at with that lens of regional leadership. So needs that look. Thank you.
All right, continuing on, the next project to bring to you has to do with the links that we have to the sites. Just as you saw in the prior diagram, what happened if we lost a core, if we lose the links to the sites, we also impair the system. One of the ways that we can, again, mitigate that is to improve the connectivity to the radio sites. We currently have them linked with a wireless network, but if we further enhance that with fiber optic connectivity, which also brings us the opportunity to connect the remaining fire stations that don't have fiber optic connectivity, we just further enhance that the reliability of that network, as well as prepare it for the future when we're handling additional services over that network. The next project talks a little bit about the support of the radio infrastructure, having to do with the communications of building itself. There are a couple of things there. We've actually already mentioned the emergency generators once this morning. There is also an uninterruptible power source that's in that building so that while the generators are starting, everything continues to operate. That is aging and is in need of updating. It's also located in the basement, which is not an ideal location if we were to have any kind of flooding. As well as the generators, we've already talked about the fact that there's ventilation challenges with those. Those are aging as well, and also located in the basement of the building. So the proposal would be to move those out of the building and at grade or above. And then the last is the cooling system for the building. All of that electronic equipment in the building requires 24/7, 365 days a year of cooling. So there are some improvements that we need to make there to make sure that we have good backup capability so that we don't compromise the operation if there's a failure of that equipment. And this last project that I have to bring to you has to do with the fire, the infrastructure to put together a VHF system for fire, as you heard discussed last week. The emphasis in the hazard zones that you heard discussed last week had to do with radio-to-radio communications on fire scenes. What this does is allow the dispatch center to monitor what's going on in those situations and provide the services that they provide, the support they provide, and the ability to support the activation of an emergency button, for example, if that were to occur. The number that I have here, as you saw, was a range. We're still working on some of the requirements and then some of the system design that needs to be completed before we come up with a firm number for that. And this last slide is a summary of the projects that I brought before you this morning. Are there any questions?
Any questions?
So this would be, I think, from all council, when we met with public safety, this was, from a priority standpoint, the communications was the highest one for everyone, just because of what it obviously represents. The current system was purchased in bond election in, do you remember what that was, Randy?
It was installed in 2002. I don't remember.
So it had been right before then. So it's been there for a while. Now we're in 2013. So the life cycle of the communication systems have come up, as Randy was talking about. So we have, I think Randy made it very clear, we've done very, it's been important to us, regardless of what the governance is related to public safety communications, and also considering where Maricopa County is going, because they are out looking at a new system right now. that the equipment we're talking about is consistent with regardless of those decisions. And as a matter of fact, I think there's an initiative by, or at least some discussion by the RWC about that they will be also going out about the same time as we are looking to upgrade their equipment. Is that correct, Randy?
Yes, that's correct.
We've been in close conversations with them to make sure that we're all kind of going together on these communication systems parallel.
Mayor? So. What is the life cycle of this technology? I mean, how long throw it up? How long until you have to replace it?
The typical life cycle for the infrastructure is in the range of 15 years. So we're in 2016, we'll be right at that time frame.
And then, so if we're going to bond finance this, I would presume that that would be paid for in the bond prior, it'd be paid off prior to the end of the life cycle.
Oh,
I know we're very careful about that, but I hate.
Yeah, we can
20-year debt for a 15-year
life cycle. And we've done that in the past where we've been able to structure the financing or paying of the debt off sooner. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we talked about the last bond issue.
We did that. I can't remember what it was that we.
Well, we do the fire trucks.
Oh, the fire trucks, right. The apparatus. All right, thank you.
I just want to be really.
And other equipment.
Yeah,
we do that.
Yes.
We would. Technology is something that I really struggle going into debt to do. I mean, we really need to figure out how to, you know, do regular.
We,
you know, so it's not, we don't have to do it in chunks.
Yeah.
That we debt finance, you know, if we can figure out how to eventually get it into our.
Yeah, and what you don't even what you don't even see here are all of the handhelds.
Right, the mobile and portable.
Mobile portables, which will have to be, I mean, and you can't finance those in debt. And that we kind of split this up a little bit because together with that, those were another, how much?
Those are about another 10 or
so was
12 million.
When I first saw this, was this a $30-plus million component. And then we were trying to separate out the pieces and try to figure, well, what could we aggressively try to put aside and pay with, you know, pay as you go now.
Do we have we set up a fund? I mean, I know we have the vehicle replacement fund.
That was
do
where
we not
we
have
a
handheld replacement fund?
We don't yet. Yeah, well, we came to that conclusion too.
Oh.
Again,
can we sell the vehicle?
Here's the challenge. That sounds great, right? And that sounds like a reasonable thing to do. But every dollar you set aside for purchasing those, you know, building up that reserve for radios, means it's a less dollar to go into everything that competes with it. Employee compensation, commodities,
well,
fuel. I understand.
Yeah, the discussion we've had here, we can't have two separate discussions. If communications is the most essential, and I believe it is, especially when you're on site, and having that near 100% reliability rate is essential, you know, it seems like on the list of priorities, that would be at the utmost. Like I said, you know, the worst thing is to pay a highly trained professional, put them in harm's way by not being able to communicate with them in an emergency. I know it competes, but it seems to me we've heard from, and if you want to talk about the stakeholders, one was just here last week that said, "Listen, this is the most important thing."
Yep.
I got to take him at his word, and it would seem to me that if you can't communicate. It doesn't matter how nice your fire station is or how nice your fire truck is.
As long as we all understand what it competes with.
Well, I'm just throwing this out there. If I'm wrong.
Well, the fire department, I think, has some tough choices to make. I mean, because this is. I mean,
well, we all have. But I'm just setting the stage. It would seem like those priorities have been laid out as though this, at the end of the day, is about the most important thing there is, the ability to communicate.
We agree.
Okay.
We agree.
Just quick.
Yeah, Vice Mayor.
On our comprehensive list of CIP under PD was some major items, $12 million and others. I think it's the same thing. It was fiber optic broadband expansion. Were these captured in this
presentation?
They're
not redundant, I don't think.
No, so we have all those other costs that are captured under
another. Well, let me ask you, on broadband and that, isn't there, can we, is this a separate system we're setting up with fiber optic, or is this, because you know, it seems like the CenturyLinks of the world have laid down a broadband system. Do we not have the ability to utilize existing core systems that have been set up by the private sector?
We are clearly setting up our own network. There might be an opportunity to leverage some of that. We'd have to figure out if it serves the locations that we need to serve, and if it fit economically as far as operating costs would go. Because clearly it would be an ongoing operating expense to use their facilities.
Yeah, my understanding is, and I was saying, fiber optics are basically almost limitless as to the capacity they can take. It would seem like if you've got already an established system, I'd at least like to explore that and see. Okay. I know there's reliability, service, accessibility, those kinds of things, but on the other hand, it would seem like if it's there, and we could use backup, we use the wireless as a backup. I'm assuming that's like microwave primarily. That would then be our backup in case the system went down, in case somebody went out and cut a fiber optic and you couldn't reroute, you'd have that backup. Councilmember Summers and then Councilmember Richens.
There's a question and a comment in here, so I'll try to wrap it both of them together. There is a lot being done at the national level by FirstNet, SafeCom, national communications and a public safety network. This is an extremely complicated issue, and the work of FirstNet and SafeCom, and I'm on those boards, is just starting. So the question component of this is, I think most of what we've been discussing here is voice communication. So with this CIP, where does that regional data communication, how is that going to fit into the infrastructure that we are being asked to invest in here?
Councilmember Summers, as we've discussed, and I know you're part of that and heavily involved in the initiative, City of Mesa, TRWC, RWC are heavily involved. Additionally, the state has been given the leadership role in that initiative by the federal government. When they created FirstNet, they made the leadership role, assigned the leadership role to the state. So we're working with them regularly. There is a process in place for grant money to develop the partnerships with the systems that are currently in place. So they're talking with us in Phoenix and Maricopa County as they build their networks, as well as all the other initiatives in the state, Pima County, Pinal County, Yuma. Tax relief legislation is actually what started this, is how they hid the two together. It provided $6 billion in funding for this project nationwide. The current estimates are that's only about half of what it would cost to build this network nationwide. So we've got a gap. Obviously, they'll target the bigger cities first as they go through the list. They've got some demonstration cities, such as San Francisco and Charlotte and a few others that have a grant funding. Mesa was involved in that original project. We applied for a grant, but we did not get the grant. We had funding to build our own broadband network. But when FirstNet came on board, they took away our license and ability to do that. So we're poised to do that. We're ready to do it. We know how to do it. The assets we have in place, our towers, the fiber optics from this project will go to be used to build that broadband network to give our first responders broadband in all their vehicles and on all their equipment.
And there are going to be a lot of governance issues related to this, too. There's discussions on hardening sites, which is physical. There's discussions on whether or not we share resources with the private sector. The issue there is about prioritization, whether or not public safety can bounce somebody off their cell phone call because we're trying to communicate in and out of the hot zone. So there are a lot of issues that have to be resolved, and some of it at the national level, but we need to keep, and I know, Alex, that you're involved with that too. We got to keep an eye out on how this infrastructure potentially is going to tie in to that national model, and on the regional approach too, and just making sure that we still can communicate, between the Phoenix base and the Mesa base and back each other up. I think that's going to be extremely important for that regional model that the mayor admired over in Japan.
Councilmember Richens?
I'm going to agree with Councilmember Summers about a strong push for a regional solution, because these costs I don't think we can bear long term on our own, and then building our own infrastructure all the time. I think we really have to look at what corporate America is doing and what infrastructure can be shared. But the regional leadership is going to be key to making this cost effective in the future, because I don't think Mesa can continue to swallow these costs with all the other competing demands.
What? Well, just so I'm clear, though, but won't we have the same relative and proportionate
costs? It would be essentially every community would have these same relative costs, And then there's the infrastructure that connects them. But as I understand it, this would be there, and you can see there is an element in here we've assumed would be a regional share. There's about $3 million in here that would be part of the regional share around us. So we've assumed that they would have to step up.
I mean, whether those costs are funneled or are borne individually or funneled through a regional, basically, if a tower serves geographically Mesa, even if it's governed by a regional system, basically it's our cost. And we and a tower is towers that can that communities can share, whether on a individual system or on a regional, would be borne proportionately by those communities, right?
Yeah, and we go through that process today.
Right.
There's a tremendous effort in calculating those shared resources, infrastructure, and allocating those costs across.
And what we would hope is that when we have towers, and base equipment and those things, maybe you could maybe that's where redundancies exist. But it seems like what you've proposed here, a lot of those would be our proportional responsibility, whether we're on a regional system or on an.
But we've identified.
Isn't the idea that a regional system would have some kind of economy of scale to it? I mean, why bother? If you're not getting an economy of scale, then it's pointless to pursue a regional. I mean, that's the whole point of pursuing a regional system. Yeah, you want everybody to be able to talk to each other, but it's also we're trying to make it more cost efficient for the taxpayer. So does it have a does regionalism have a cost efficiency to it or not?
I can answer that from the current two regional systems that exist today in the Valley between the RWC and TRWC. From an operating expense cost, our cost is cheaper than the RWC's cost on a per unit cost by about 10%. So the scale doesn't seem to work in that perspective. And I can't talk about their books, but when they look at what they cost their members per unit, ours is 10% cheaper.
But there are ways, and we've worked, what we mentioned, like at the tower, where you're able to bring multiple entities on. And remember, when we talk about regional, we always kind of forget there's overlapping jurisdictions here that we're trying to work with.
Maricopa County.
I mean, our biggest challenge for the police department is on the east side communicating with the county.
County isn't ingrained with any system. They're on their own system.
So we're trying to bring all
DPS
the...
DPS also.
We're trying to bring the issues that concern us on our western boundary, which are real, but there's some very real issues on our eastern boundary also. And so we're trying to play within all these systems. And I think as much as possible, I think within the systems across the region, and as you saw, we work with DPS to work with their tower. So every time there's an opportunity to where there's the larger infrastructure that where they can we can pull together those resources, I think we do that. I think what you've seen here is what we've identified is really what has to happen within Mesa. We did identify there's over $3 million we believe are a regional benefit, and we would pursue that funding from our regional partners. So we are finding ways to make it work, to your point of economy scale. Unfortunately, at some point, when you have 450,000 or 140 square miles, what has to happen in Mesa is still a pretty big number.
Well, those economies, once again, communications is about geography and units.
Right.
And, you know, you're not going to gain an economy if you have to still cover the same geography and the same units. You'll gain economies when there is a common equipment. That would seem like maybe a base site. And even that's a geography type of thing. Shared towers,
right?
In terms of shared towers,
Maricopa County is, as you said, they're building a system that overlays both the RWC and TRWC. But we're still sharing assets when we can. They've came out and looked at all the Mesa tower sites just for that purpose, to put equipment on existing tower sites. And Randy has identified those, and I believe it'll be no charge. Back, you know, reciprocal arrangements again for them to use our assets we've already built.
And I think wasn't the driving force of looking at a regional system not so much cost, although I think there can be some things, but system reliability and interoperability
cost. And remember, we sometimes forget the fruits of, and I know there was a lot of criticism about the split, but the fruits of that split also, there were some incredibly positive things with that split. We were able to bring together a region that then came together on a joint effort to bring ambulance services to the region. We have a lot of joint, because what brought us together, so dispatching, and Councilor Summers talking about the dispatching, is a regional dispatching component, and we're trying to hold that together because he think that has a lot of benefit to have a regional dispatching. I think even Mr. Jeffries brought up the idea of even maybe expanding that beyond what we have today. So all those are opportunities.
Yeah, no, if I may, Mayor, there's no doubt. Let me be clear. Phoenix Mesa Metro, does it arguably better than any other community, I think. I'll hold this up against any system, and we will reap the benefits of that. But there are still opportunities to marry these systems so that it truly is one, a regional system, Mesa backing up Phoenix, Phoenix backing up Mesa. The technology works together, and it will not only protect our UASI region, the Urban Area Security Initiative's a region, I don't want to owe the mayor a quarter, but the state, because much of the state relies on Phoenix Mesa in this arena to be able to respond. So,
okay. Vice Mayor?
Just quickly, away from this broader look, big frustration for me, you hear it all the time, planned obsolescence. I share Mr. Richin's frustration when we look at these huge ticket items and 3 years, 5 years down the road, suddenly we're not going to support that anymore because this is big business and big money. So a lot of frustration. I feel like they hold the government entities hostage on these deals. So whatever brilliance you can bring to this to try and protect us from what I would call predatory planned obsolescence, I'd appreciate it. Sorry for
the predatory planned obsolescence.
Yeah. We have a new one.
I like it.
So when he just talks about PPOs, we know what we're talking about now. Predatory planned obsolescence.
Vice Mayor Finter, from that perspective, what Councilmember Summers talked about is this national network, which would not leave a single player as we have today in the public safety arena in charge of or have us to that, as you said, planned obsolescence. It will create a more diverse field for players to come in, commercial carriers, public-private partnerships. Right now there's a company with that name begins with an M that really runs public safety for the whole country.
Yeah.
And in the future, this plan by the federal government will help that greatly, but it is years away.
Okay. All righty. Well, hopefully with what we've talked about over the last couple of weeks and the Topaz Regional Board, Mr. Cross as the chair leading that, we'll have these discussions on a regional basis. So I'd really like to know, though, I mean, I just know fiber optics exists. If you could come back and give me at least some things, there may be some very basic reasons why we can't piggyback or utilize existing fiber optic system, but I'd like to know that.
Sure.
They were actively talking to the incumbents in the region for a number of fiber optic projects, specifically for downtown and the density of need we'll have down there for schools for gigabit and high broadband. We can include that in the subject.
Yeah, if you would, please. Yeah. Yep. I'd like to understand that better. Okay. Thank you. All right.
You up for more, or what do you want to do?
You have audit and finance.
So you want to? So can we go to executive session then? And then
let's go to e-session, okay? We have a motion to go to session from Councilmember Kavanaugh, a second from Councilmember Summers. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
You're outvoted. We're moving into
first
executive
record
session.
Of a vote against.